Running, a Due South Story by Luzula, read by Helen 78. Carolyn is down at the willows around the frozen creek, snuffling after the fresh tracks of a hare, when she hears her mother scream. The sound is brief and choked off, but full of pain. Carolyn is running for the cabin before she can think about it, and the fear hits her a moment later like a jolt of energy, speeding her paws over the snow. Her father is away trapping and hunting, and too much can go wrong living alone as they do. It is the deep of winter, and the cold does not forgive mistakes. The cabin isn't far. Carolyn sees her mother in the shoveled-out path to the woodshed. She is moving slowly, like wounded prey. No smell of blood, though. Her mother looks up, face white and focused against the pain. "My leg. Broke it when the log slipped. Was going to saw up that big one." She breathes in short, gasping puffs of white air. The leg bends oddly, even through her heavy clothing. A wolf with a broken leg will die. Her mother is going to die. Carolyn whines, a high-pitched keening sound, and she can't seem to stop. "Carolyn!" Her mother's voice is sharp and desperate. Carolyn shakes her body and forces herself to think like a human. Humans don't need to die from broken legs if they can get help. A doctor. Her mother needs a doctor. But the sledding team is with her father. "Fetch help from the Thompsons. I'll wait in the cabin." Carolyn yips sharply in confirmation, and her mother hobbles slowly toward the door. Carolyn tries to help her get there. "I'll make it. Go." Her mother's tone is tightly controlled. Used to obeying that voice, Carolyn turns and starts to run, east toward the Thompsons. It's only 2 miles, and she's a fast runner, but when she gets close to their house, there is no smell of wood smoke in the air, and her frantic barks go unanswered. They are not there. Grimly, Carolyn continues to run, past the house, and eastward along the trail. She slows down. The burst of speed that took her to the Thompson's house is not something she can keep up for long, but if she paces herself, she can run all the way to Fort McPherson if she has to. As a human, she never could have gone so far without a sled. Carolyn lolls her tongue out, cooling off while she runs. She is a spark of life in the cold. She can run forever, the one moving creature in a world frozen into stillness. A scent trail pulls her nose to the side. It's fresh and less than an hour old. A dog sled. No, 2 sleds. She hesitates, then turns left, following their trail. They are fast, but she is faster. Carolyn spots them, 2 dark smudges up ahead. She gains on them, but the wind is from behind her, carrying her scent to the dog teams. They bark, the warning of tame animals for the wild cousin they have left behind, and the drivers stop the sleds and look around. One of them spots her and points, shouting to the other, who reaches into the sled. Carolyn stops, frozen into place. She is staring into the muzzle of a rifle. With the desperation of fear, she reaches for her human self and changes, losing her fur and her paws and her sharp nose. She shivers, naked in the bitter cold. They still might shoot her when they realize what she is. "Great Scott," she distinctly hears one of them say, and he lowers the rifle. Carolyn steps through the snow toward them, arms uselessly hugging her chest. Her nipples have contracted painfully, and her feet are rapidly fading away to numbness. One of the men grabs a blanket from the sled and comes running up to her. She wraps it around herself gratefully. "Thank you," she says, through chattering teeth. "You're welcome," he says, looking anywhere but at her. He's blushing a deep red. Carolyn has no patience for modesty at the moment. She needs to save her feet. When she reaches the sleds, the other man has cleared a space for her to sit on one of them, and she curls in around herself, shivering inside the blanket. The wind still cuts through it. The first man takes off his hat and puts it on her head, then wraps his jacket around her. He clears his throat. "Constable Bob Fraser, RCMP. The other man says, "And I'm Constable Buck Frobisher." He's red in the face, too, even though she's all wrapped up now. Carolyn is struck by how young they both look. Only a couple of years older than her. Carolyn Pinsent, "My mother needs a doctor. Please, can you help us?" Carolyn hears her voice break a little. She hates feeling so helpless. "Of course we will. Where is she?" Constable Frobisher says. About 8 miles west of here. I can show you the way. Her teeth are still chattering. She considers changing back, but decides not to. It would disturb the dog teams. Also, these men don't seem to be hostile to shifters, but it wouldn't do to push her luck. Are you all right, miss? Constable Fraser says. You must have taken quite a chill. Call me Carolyn. She wiggles her toes, looking at them. They're red, not white, so she should be all right, even if her whole body is still shaking with the cold. I think I'm okay, she says. He still looks worried. Let's get you bedded down. I think there's more room on my sled.
There's plenty of room on mine, Constable Frobisher objects. Well, you'll have all the dog food. She shouldn't have to sit with the raw meat.
Carolyn smiles to herself. What do they think she eats as a wolf? She's soon settled in Constable Fraser's sled, with two sleeping bags around her. Her body heat slowly inches its way down her feet into her toes, leaving tingling pain in its wake. She isn't worried, though. Shifters have an easier time staying warm than ordinary people. The dogs are still wary of her, but they're well-trained. They run steadily in front of her now, the gangline taut as they pull the sled back along their own tracks. It's not comfortable, exactly. The snow is packed on the open ground, which makes for a bumpy ride. But Carolyn is deeply grateful anyway. She wonders how her mother is doing, alone and in pain. Now that she thinks about it, running off like that was quite a dangerous plan. The Thompsons are friends, so they would have helped. But if she'd had to run all the way to Fort McPherson, what would she have done? Run down the main street as a wolf? Or naked? She shakes her head. Of course, her aunt lives there, and she's a shifter. But could she have reached her without being seen? Carolyn is blazing with heat now, only the tip of her nose cold from the wind. Constable Fraser's mittened hands are on the handle of the sled, just above her head, and she hears his occasional grunts of exertion and yelled commands to the dogs. The thought strikes Carolyn that not all men might have treated a naked woman as well as these did. She didn't have time to think about it before, but now she pulls up her upper lip in a silent snarl. If they had tried anything, she would have changed again and torn their throats out. They reach the cabin, and her mother is carried out by the two men. Constable Frobisher carefully holds her leg out in front of her. Her eyes widen in alarm when she sees Carolyn bedded down in the sled. I'm all right, Carolyn tells her. Her mother nods, looking relieved.
Would you like me to fetch you some clothes? Constable Fraser says, obviously uncomfortable with the topic.
Please. My boots and long coat are by the door. I can get to the cabin in those. All right. He gets the clothes, and the two men politely turn their backs while Carolyn steps into the boots and wraps the coat around her. Her mother takes her place among the sleeping bags. She looks worn out, and Carolyn tries not to think about what the long, bumpy ride will be like for her.
Don't you worry, says Constable Frobisher. We'll get her to the hospital, and she'll be fine.
Thank you again, both of you, Carolyn says.
Will you be all right alone here? Constable Fraser says, frowning in worry.
My father is coming home the day after tomorrow. I'll be fine, Carolyn replies. We might be back to check on you, just in case. He fiddles with the snub line on the sled.
Well, I guess we should get going.
They take their leave of her, and the dogs start running eagerly. Carolyn's legs are cold, but she stands by the door and watches the sleds until they are out of sight. End. This has been a reading of Running, a Due South Story by Luzula. For more of the author's work, visit archiveofourown.org/users/Luzula. Packmates, a Due South Story by Luzula, read by Helen78. Carolyn had just curled up in her favorite armchair by the fire with a book in her hand when there was a stamping on the porch and a knock on the door. Carolyn, would you see who it is? Her mother called from the kitchen. I will, she said with a sigh, getting up again. She would never be finished with her book at this rate. But instead of a neighbor or her aunt, she found Bob and Buck outside the door, still brushing snow off their clothes and boots. Her face lit up with a wide smile.
We were in the neighborhood, and Bob began, but Buck elbowed him in the side. In the neighborhood, indeed. You don't want to know how many extra miles we sledded to get to this neighborhood. Bob gave him a black look, and Carolyn tried not to smile. She took hold of the sleeve of his parka and firmly pulled him inside. "Come in, both of you. You're letting in the cold." She kissed Bob on the lips, and he blushed, to a most charming effect. "Ooh, you lovebirds," Buck muttered, and Carolyn felt herself blushing as well. "What, us?" Bob said. "Hey, I saw you making eyes at that girl in Red River." Buck didn't deny it. By now, her mother had come out of the kitchen, drying her hands on a dish towel. "Oh, hello, Constable Fraser, Constable Frobisher." She nodded at them. "I'll put on some tea, shall I?" "Thank you kindly, Mrs. Pinsent," Bob said. They took off their layers until they were down to flannel shirts and trousers, while Carolyn helped her mother set the table. "Oh, there was no need," Buck said when he saw the bread and cold meat and pound cake they had set out, but he trailed off, looking longingly at it. "Nonsense," her mother said. "Sledding gives you an appetite, I know that for a fact." They both ate heartily, while Carolyn drank her tea and made herself a sandwich. Bob's hand sought out hers under the table and pressed it. She ran her thumb along his warm, solid fingers, and her stomach flipped over. Then she let go, trying to look innocent. She could take Buck's good-natured ribbing, but she wasn't about to try anything more under her mother's sharp eyes. Not that she had anything to hide. They were engaged, after all. "Do you need a place to sleep tonight?" her mother asked. "We only have one sofa, so one of you would have to sleep on the floor, but you're welcome to stay." "No, we have business at the detachment, and they have a few cots. We'll stay there." "But thank you kindly for offering," Bob said, with an earnest politeness that Carolyn suspected was entirely for her mother's benefit. "Where are you heading tomorrow?" Carolyn asked. Bob and Buck glanced at each other. Then Buck sighed. "All right, I suppose we should tell them."
"Tell us what?" Carolyn asked. "Is anything the matter?"
Bob cleared his throat.
"There's trouble in Aklavik, and since it concerns, well, your people, we thought you should know."
Her mother put down her teacup with a sharp clink.
"What kind of trouble?"
"Folks are saying that you, well, they, Bob said.
"The shifters," her mother filled in impatiently.
"Yes, well, that they're stealing game from the traps. And one of the, shifters has been killed. It was blamed on a hunting accident, but we think it might not have been an accident. We're going up there to take a look."
Carolyn felt a chill go down her spine.
"Doesn't Aklavik have its own RCMP detachment?" she asked.
Bob and Buck looked at each other again.
"It's only a small one," Buck said.
"And they're not particularly interested in looking into the death of a shifter who is shot as a wolf,"
Carolyn's mother finished grimly. Neither of the men contradicted her.
"Well, thanks for warning us," Carolyn said. Before they left, Carolyn managed to get a few words alone with Bob.
"You be careful," she said.
"No, you be careful," Bob said. "We'll be all right, but that shifter who is shot could have been you."
Carolyn squeezed his hands. "I haven't heard any rumors of game stealing here, and I've got my parents and my aunt. Don't worry about me." She brought one of his hands up to her mouth and kissed the knuckles. This made him smile, as she had thought it would.
"Bob, were you planning to stay here after all?" Buck called innocently from the door. "I'm coming, hold your horses," he called, then muttered, "or dogs, rather."
He gave Carolyn a quick hug and went to put his outdoor clothes and boots on. She watched from the doorway as they left, tipping their hats at her and then urging the dogs on. Carolyn's family had moved into town the summer before last. Her mother's broken leg had shown them all too well how vulnerable it was to live in an isolated cabin, especially with her father away so often on trapping expeditions. Fort McPherson was safer, although it was harder to hide what they were among so many people. Of course, her father wasn't a shifter, but he'd thrown in his lot with them. As they cleared away the dishes, her mother frowned. "I'm worried about what they told us. Did you know that Susan went up to Aklavik yesterday?"
"No. What is she doing there?" Carolyn asked, worried.
Her Aunt Susan was a shifter, too, and part of their pack. "We have a cousin living up there, and her husband has died. Susan went to help her take care of the children and arrange for the funeral." Carolyn was instantly suspicious. "Was her husband one of us? How did he die?" Her mother nodded. "That's what I'm wondering, too. I know he was one of us." Carolyn sat down on a chair, trying to think. "What should we do? Susan might not know the danger she's in. We have to help her."
The bonds of a pack were strong, and no shifter would leave a pack member in danger.
"I'm coming with you," Carolyn said. "There's no need for both of us to go. I wish your father were home. But still, it's safer for you to stay at home. He'll be coming home soon."
"No, I'm pack too." Carolyn felt the beginnings of a growl rise in her throat. "And my fiancé is up there. I want to be where he is."
Her mother turned to face her with an answering growl. They stared at each other. Carolyn wasn't about to back down, though, and finally her mother nodded.
"All right."
Carolyn felt a surge of satisfaction. Her mother was still alpha, but she could hold her own.
It was the first heavy snow of the winter, and Bob slogged on behind the sled so as not to add to the dog's burden. Not a breath stirred in the forest except for his and Buck's, and the panting of the team. The branches of the trees were covered in round little cushions of powdery snow, turning the dark spruces into white lacy confections. Perfect for tapping at an opportune moment, for example, when one's partner was standing underneath. Bob pictured Buck spluttering as cold snow fell down his neck, and smiled. They reached the more heavily trafficked route between Red River and Aklavik, and the dogs pulled with new strength as they felt the packed snow hold their weight. Bob jumped up on the runners with a huff of relief. He was fit enough, but wading through powder snow could take it out of anyone.
"Lunch?" Buck called out behind him. "Can't take it anymore?" Bob called back innocently. "No, I thought you needed to lighten your load." "Ha!" As if the consumption of some tea leaves, pemmican, and biscuits would make any difference. Nevertheless, they stopped the sleds and heated water on their little stove, letting the dogs roll around in the snow and then settle into round little balls of fur. They knew to take rest when they could.
Buck blew on his tea.
"It's a bad business up in Aklavik."
Bob grunted in assent, busy with the biscuit tin.
"Do you suppose there's any truth to that story about the shifters poaching the game?" Buck asked.
"Game is scarce everywhere. There's no need to blame it on them."
"True. And even if they were poaching, murder isn't the way to stop it. Not that we know for sure it was murder."
"My guts are telling me it was."
"No, that's your gut wanting more pemmican," Buck grinned. "Can't tell the difference?"
"The nerve of you. The only thing your gut produces is flatulence."
Buck laughed. Having thus brought the conversation to the lowest possible level, they both finished their meal in companionable silence and set off again for Aklavik.
"How will we travel?" Carolyn asked.
"On foot, of course. It will be the quickest way, and besides, your father has the sledding team," her mother said. Shifters were often reluctant to travel in human shape in the winter time. Why expose oneself to the cold and the weariness of walking on two legs when one didn't have to?
"But do you know how to find Susan when we get to Aklavik? I mean, what if someone sees us?"
They would be naked as the day they were born when they transformed back into human shape, and Carolyn knew from experience that it was best to think about these things while you were still a human. Wolves didn't care much about such things.
Her mother frowned.
I don't know my cousin well, and I've never been to Aklavik before. But I do know that their house is on the outskirts of town. It would almost have to be, since her husband was one of us."
Carolyn nodded. That was good enough for her.
"All right, let's go then." They took their clothes off and folded them neatly on the sofa, left a note to Carolyn's father to explain what had happened, then closed the front door behind them. It was bitterly cold, but they didn't feel it for long. Soon there was nothing left at the cabin but two sets of wolf tracks in single file, heading north. As she ran through the snow, Carolyn felt something that was almost the exhilaration of the hunt. She was going to rescue her pack. More, she would be with her mate. She would help him catch those who threatened the pack. If she had been in human shape, she might have called it an adventure, but that was a concept foreign to the wolf mind. That night, Carolyn and her mother hunted together. They had done so ever since Carolyn had first changed. A gangly 13-year-old girl turned into an awkward half-grown puppy, and her mother had taught her how to read the scents on the wind and on the ground. The rabbit was white in its newly grown winter coat, and still fat from the autumn. Carolyn drove it into her mother's waiting jaws, and they tore at the meat, swallowing down the guts and worrying at the remains until there was only a patch of red snow and a few bones and slivers of fur left. Then they lay down to sleep under the branches of a spruce, turning around to flatten the snow to a comfortable nest. The houses of Aklavik came into view suddenly, hidden by the trees until they were right upon them. They were closed in on themselves, wrapped in snow as if to keep their precious warmth inside. Wood smoke from the chimneys rose nearly straight up in the windless air.
"Right. Where do we start?" Bob asked, stopping to let Buck pull up beside him on the road, which was broader than the track they had come along. Immediately, the dogs started bickering.
"Stop that, you mangy excuses for huskies," Buck called, then turned to Bob.
"The detachment, I suppose? They must have done at least some work on the case. And the widow of the victim, of course, although perhaps that should wait until we get a feel for the case."
"Yes, and the company store. Seeing as it's about trapping, if they don't know anything about it, I'll eat my hat."
"So many times you've said that, and you still have your hat."
Buck shook his head sadly.
"That's because I'm always right, you ninny."
"You just go on believing that."
They pulled up at the detachment and staked their dogs in the back, carefully keeping them apart from the team already there. There was a dreadful din as the Aklavik dogs almost barked their heads off defending their territory. An officer came out to see what all the noise was about.
"Hey, where did you come in from?"
"South. Fort McPherson was our latest stop."
"Come on in. I'll make you some tea, and you can tell me your business."
He shivered a little in the freezing air and quickly disappeared indoors again. When they had told Constable Wright why they were there, he wasn't best pleased.
"We can handle the case on our own. No need to bring in outside help."
Bob glanced at Buck. Neither of them were particularly good at diplomacy. Buck cleared his throat.
"I'm sure you've done a good job, but it's a bit of a sensitive case, you know. Could be good to have an outside opinion on it."
"Who sent you here?"
"Inspector Carson in Red River," Bob said. To be more specific, he'd sent them after Bob had pestered him about it, and he'd given in, so it wasn't exactly a lie.
Constable Wright looked resigned.
"Well, investigate all you want. Not that there's much of a case, anyway. A man sees a wolf that looks threatening, he's got the right to fire in self-defense."
Bob was surprised by the sudden tightening of his gut in anger. He'd never have reacted like that before he knew Carolyn, and he bit his lip to keep the sharp words back. Wouldn't do to make an enemy of the man. It turned out that Constable Wright, who was indeed the officer in charge of the case, didn't know much. He'd taken the shooter at his word, and seeing as Constable Wright was a newcomer to the area, he didn't know much about the local community. His superior, Sergeant Fortier, was due in tomorrow, and there were two more officers at the detachment, but they were on patrol for a week.
"Well, thanks for nothing," Bob muttered as they closed the door of the detachment behind them. "He couldn't investigate his way out of a paper bag."
Buck snorted. "That's why we're here. The company office next, I suppose?"
"Right you are."
The fur trade with the Hudson's Bay Company was in decline, but it had been the major institution in the area for so long that it was still simply called the Company. The senior official was one of the old breed, a man in his 60s who looked like he'd been there since the 19th century. Maybe he had.
"Good afternoon, sir," Bob said, taking off his hat as they came into the office. His mother had taught him well, and anyway, courtesy could pay off.
"We'd like to consult with you about a case, if you have the time."
"John Howitt." The man shook hands with them both and gestured for them to sit down.
"Well, I'll do my best to help you. I know this area like the back of my hand."
"What do you know about the shifters in this area?"
Observing him closely, Bob thought he saw a slight wariness in his face.
"Not much. They keep themselves to themselves, if you know what I mean. They're pretty close-mouthed. Oh, there's one or two that's an open secret. Everybody knows they're shifters, even if they don't talk about it. But there are shifters that nobody knows about, you can be sure of that." He laughed. "Hell, I could be one for all you know."
To humor him, Bob laughed along with him. Buck asked, "What's the attitude towards them?"
"Well, if they don't trust us, we don't exactly trust them either."
Bob noted the us and we. Howitt continued, "I suppose you're here over that unfortunate hunting accident."
"Well, it was an accident, make no mistake. How's a man to know one wolf from another?" He shrugged.
Trying another tack, Bob asked, "How's the trapping in this area? Game scarce?"
Howitt sighed. "Scarce and getting scarcer. I remember the good old days when a trapper could bring in twice as many skins in half the time. There was profit in the business then. But times are changing."
"You think the shifters are to blame?" Buck asked.
The wariness came back.
"Well, there's no denying they kill some game. And some say they've found chewed-off remains of animals in their traps." They asked a few more questions, but they couldn't get much more out of Howitt. As they left the company offices, Buck gestured backwards with a thumb. "He knows something, I could bet on it."
No bet, Bob said. I think you're right. But he's an old fox. Won't let anything slip unless he wants to. Buck grunted in agreement, and they headed towards the general store to sound out the mood there.
Long before they reached Aklavik, Carolyn could smell a hint of the wood smoke from its hearths, sharp and acrid in her nose. It was evening, and the forest was stirring with the life that woke with the setting of the sun. An owl flew above on almost soundless wings, looking for smaller prey than wolves. They ignored it, as well as their own empty stomachs, and read the scents written in the snow. This area belonged to a different pack, and they were uneasy trespassers. But they saw no one, neither shifter nor human, while they circled the outskirts of the town. Nose to the ground, the messages were clear. Someone had marked territory here, an alpha male. Another had fed here, or passed along the trail there. Doubtless there were other tracks, too, buried by the heavy snow. Anyway, it was clear that these were the marks of their own kind. Wild wolves would not come so close to a town. Suddenly her mother woofed and raised her head. Carolyn trotted over and smelled the tracks of Susan, a few days old. They followed the tracks to a cabin marked by another shifter, their eyes and ears and noses alert for danger. But the markings were old, made at least a week ago. There was light in the cabin windows, and Carolyn jumped up with her paws to the wall to look inside. She blinked against the light and then saw Susan by the kitchen table, with another woman she didn't know. Her mother scratched with her paw on the door. The porch vibrated with steps coming closer, and then the door opened. "Goodness!" a woman's voice cried out, but before she could say more, they both piled in the door and shifted into two naked heaps on the floor. "Anne," Susan exclaimed, "what on earth are you doing here?" The unknown woman went to get them blankets and some clothes to borrow. Carolyn's mother stood up. Wrapping herself in the blanket, she said, "Someone in this town seems to be out to kill shifters, and I came to warn you about the danger." The strange woman flinched at the mention of killing shifters, and Carolyn realized she must be her mother's cousin, who had been married to the shifter who'd been killed. But Susan and her mother were already in a full-blown argument. "And you just rushed off? What made you think it was a good idea to just appear on someone's doorstep like that? What if there had been other people in the house?" "Oh, there weren't any, were there?" her mother said, in the reasonable older sister tone that always set Susan off even more. Carolyn ducked into the kitchen. She knew from experience that it was best not to come between her mother and aunt when they were like this. The woman whose cabin they were in was sitting at the table, looking worn out. Carolyn said, "I'm so sorry to barge in on you like this. I'm Carolyn." The woman smiled, but it didn't reach her eyes. "I'm Rita. You must be Anne's daughter. I've heard about you. Are you hungry? There's soup on the stove. Susan made it. It's very good." Carolyn would have politely declined if she hadn't been so very hungry. She felt like enough of an intruder as it was. But she thanked Rita and ladled up a bowl of soup. She tried to eat slowly and savor the food, but it was hard. Shifting back to human shape always left her ravenous. When she had finished the food, she looked around to see if she could do anything else to help. She would gladly have washed the dishes, but felt uncomfortable doing so in someone else's home. Her mother and Susan had sorted out their argument by now. Susan had a temper, but it usually flared up quickly and was gone again soon. She was talking quietly with Rita, her arm around the other woman's shoulders, and her mother was eating. There was a door ajar to another room, and she was startled to realize that someone was looking at her through the opening. It was a small boy. He was wearing pajamas, and he was silent, his eyes wide. Perhaps the argument had woken him. Carolyn quietly got to her feet, kneeling down before the boy. "Hello. I'm Carolyn, your second cousin." Or at least she supposed he was Rita's son. "What's your name?"
"Timmy."
"Timmy, shouldn't you be in bed? Do you need something?" "It's dark in here. Where's Daddy?" Oh no, she didn't know how to handle that question. "I don't know, Tim. I'll come in and stay with you if you want." He nodded, and she took his small hand in hers. Poor child, she thought, as she watched him in the dim light that came from the kitchen. She stroked his forehead. "You just close your eyes, and I'll keep watch, all right?" He obediently closed his eyes, but kept hold of her hand. Carolyn wondered if she would have children of her own one day. She hoped so. Then she thought of the way this boy's father had died, and shivered. Bob was a Mountie, and would often be in danger. No, she couldn't think like that. Instead, she began to hum a lullaby under her breath, and kept at it until Timmy's fingers had loosened around hers and his breath was low and even. Then she tiptoed out of the room and closed the door. Rita gave her a grateful look. The next evening, the shifters of Aklavik held a meeting together for the first time. They all knew of each other, of course, but there were two different packs, and they didn't easily mix. To begin with, there had been one native pack and one that had come with the white settlers. But over the years, both packs had become part native and part white as the settlers married into the community and had children. Still, packs were always territorial, and it was best to keep your distance to avoid fights. But the situation was serious, and they all knew it. Rita had not been included at first because she was not a shifter, but she had stood up for herself in a way Carolyn had not expected, given her quiet weariness yesterday. "He was my mate," Rita had said, eyes challenging. "And I know I'm not one of you, but my father was, and my cousins are, and my son might be. We're gathering because Jim is dead, and I've a right to be here." No one had denied her after that. Out of courtesy, the Fort McPherson pack was allowed as well, after they had assured everyone that they were not out to encroach on the territory of the Aklavik packs. The alpha male of Jim's pack spoke first. He was an Inuk in his late 60s, with gray streaks in his black hair. "It won't ever be the same as before the white people came. Before that, we could be more open about who we were. But now, there are many who will never understand us. I think we have become too visible. We must hide better, take care never to be seen, and make our kills farther from the town." Some nodded, but a middle-aged woman who looked to be of mixed heritage shook her head, her lips in a flat line. She looked as if she was trying not to make a sharp retort. With almost formal politeness, she said, "I don't agree, Elder. There's so little game, and even if we keep hidden, they're going to blame it on us, even though we're so much fewer than they are. It's they who are hunting too much." Carolyn guessed that she belonged to the other pack. Perhaps she was the alpha female. Different packs usually avoided each other, and when they met, there was a lot of care taken not to spark a conflict. The Elder said, "That may be true, but what do you suggest we do about it, if not hide better?" "We're in the modern age now. Why don't we appeal to the authorities?" Despite the formality of the meeting, there was a hubbub as several people tried to speak at once. "How can you even suggest such a thing?" one woman cried, and a man shouted, "My father was kept in a mental hospital until he died of it. That's what comes of telling the authorities." The Elder stood up and raised his hands for silence, and the noise died down. "One at a time, please." Rita stood up. "Jim is dead," she said. "We all know who killed him, and I want that murderer in prison for the rest of his life. That means calling in the police." She wasn't the only one who mourned Jim. There was pain on the faces of his pack members. But the Inuit elder was slowly shaking his head. Before he could reply, Carolyn's mother stood up, to Carolyn's surprise. She herself wouldn't have spoken up. This was for the Aklavik packs to decide. "There are two RCMP constables in town to investigate the murder," Carolyn's mother said. "One of them will be married to Carolyn next year, and they're both good men. They know about us," she gestured towards herself and Carolyn, "and they've always treated us well. I'm sure they would help you." There was a moment of surprise, and then another burst of talking. But at the end of the day, nothing was decided. The habit of hiding ran too deep for the packs to be able to agree on trusting to officers of the law, even if they were vouched for by two of their own. Carolyn was cooking breakfast the next day when her mother asked Rita, in her forthright way, "Do you know who did it?" Rita took a deep breath. "Yes, we all know. It was Neil Howitt. The bastard is stealing from other people's traps and blaming us. His brother works for the company, and I'm sure he knows, or at least he doesn't ask too many questions about the furs he buys." Her fists were clenched around the spoon she was holding. "Mommy, are you angry?" Timmy said, catching his mother's mood. Rita caught him up in her arms and held him tight. "Not at you, dear, not at all. I'm angry at the ones who made Daddy go away." "I'm sorry about all the bother we've brought you, staying here, all three of us," Susan said, coming with the rest of the bowls for the oatmeal. "Would you rather we left?" "No, you've been a great help. Even if you do eat more than anyone I know, except..." She broke off and then continued. "Well, except Jim. I keep thinking about him like he's still here. Anyway, I don't want to be alone.
There are some people here that, well, I thought they were my friends, but...
She looked down and didn't say any more, but Carolyn could guess. When Jim had been killed, word had gotten out that he was a shifter, and people kept away. And Jim's packmates would help her, but they might be afraid of exposing themselves.
You could move back to Fort McPherson, Carolyn's mother said. You know you'd be welcome there with us.
I'll think about it, Rita said. I moved up here for Jim, and I don't regret it, but now... Well, we'll see. She leaned her head down over Timmy's. Later that day, Carolyn volunteered to go over to the general store to buy some food, so that they wouldn't empty Rita's cupboards entirely, and to send a telegram home to their father to assure him they were safe. She'd been itching for an excuse to get out. Where were Bob and Buck? Did they know about the man who had killed Jim? Carolyn walked past the RCMP detachment on her way to the store. She glanced around the back and let her nostrils widen, picking up the scent of the dogs. Yes, those were definitely Bob and Buck's teams. Perhaps she could just see if they were there. She knocked on the door of the detachment, and it was opened by a constable a few years older than Bob and Buck. Ma'am? Can I help you?
I wonder if Constable Fraser and Constable Frobisher are here?
No, I'm sorry, they're out. He was clearly curious as to what she was doing here and how she knew the visiting officers. Shall I give them a message?
No, that's all right. Thank you kindly.
Well, no luck there. Perhaps she could find something out at the general store. She got curious glances there, too, and some weren't too polite to ask outright.
Are you staying with Rita Pitsiolik? A middle-aged woman asked.
Yes, I'm a relative of hers, come to help her with the funeral, Carolyn said.
Oh, that's nice of you. She must be having a difficult time with that little boy and all, the woman said.
Carolyn could practically smell the falseness of her sincerity. The onlookers were listening intently, even if they were pretending to mind their own business. Carolyn nodded and smiled politely, and did not volunteer any more information. She headed home with the flour and beans and oats and other necessities, frustrated that she hadn't heard anything about Bob and Buck. She was wary of asking too many questions. There was no telling who was listening. As she walked down the trampled snow path that led to the outskirts of the town where Rita lived, she heard voices ahead of her, low but distinct. Meddling outsiders, think we can't handle our own business. The two men were walking some distance ahead, far enough that an ordinary human couldn't have heard them talk. I guess we should teach them a lesson, then, the other voice said. Carolyn's heart gave a lurch, thinking at first that they were talking about the Fort McPherson pack, but the next words made it clear that wasn't the case. I heard they were off to question Neil.
Right.
He's out on the trapline to the west, eh?
Yes.
Get your gun and your dog and we'll head out. The men turned aside onto a side trail. Her mate was in danger. Carolyn tried to keep on walking at the same pace as before, while her heart pounded as if she were running. A gun? Did they mean to attack them? Kill them?
Considering we know who shot the man, this is a harder nut to crack than I thought it would be, Buck said, finishing off his tea.
Bob nodded. We can't very well arrest the man unless we know that he knew it was a shifter. What's the motive? Just plain fear of the shifters? Or something else? They'd questioned many people in the town, hoping to get a feel for the case before they approached Neil Howitt. They'd visited the cabin of Jim Pitsiolik's widow yesterday night, but she'd been out. When they'd questioned other people, there had been guarded ignorance from most of them. But the priest at the church thought shifters were the devil's own spawn, and hinted darkly that maybe they'd had the right idea back in the Middle Ages when shifters were burned at the stake. Jim's parents were clearly frightened, and when asked outright, they denied being shifters or knowing anything about Jim's death. They might be right, for all that Bob knew. Carolyn had told him that it could skip a generation.
I guess it's time to question Neil, then. Right you are, Bob said, and finished the last bite of his sandwich.
Neil's brother, John Howitt at the company, had told them that Neil was out on one of the western trap lines. It wasn't far enough out to take the sleds, so they got their snowshoes out. No snow had fallen since they had arrived, so the tracks were clear enough to follow. Not even a newly enlisted cadet could mistake the prints of a pair of snowshoes. The sun was still above the horizon, but had begun its slow decline towards sunset. Even so, the moon was almost full, so there would be light enough. The forest was quiet, with only the occasional chirp or flutter from a chickadee to break the silence. Then there was the figure of a man ahead. but it didn't seem to be Neil, if one went by the man's Inuit features. He was cleaning out a ptarmigan, staining the snow red with blood. "Good afternoon," Bob called out. "Have you seen Neil Howitt?"
"No."
All three of them knew that the man had no business hunting on someone else's trap line. The man straightened defiantly.
"Got to have food on the table. And besides, you know these trap lines go against the old treaties. These are our hunting grounds."
"Not here to enforce hunting regulations," Bob said. "Besides, the man was right. We didn't see anything, did we?"
"Not a thing," Buck said. "We're here to investigate the murder of Jim Pitsiolik."
The man seemed to relax a little.
"Right. Besides, I'm not the only one doing a little hunting on the side."
"Oh?
Well, you ask Neil Howitt when you see him where all his furs are coming from."
"Where are they coming from?" Bob asked.
"I didn't tell you."
"Of course not. We didn't even see you."
"Right then. Well, it's not the shifters taking game from other people's traps. You sure might think so from the bite marks, but maybe you should look twice."
The man took his ptarmigan and raised his hand to bid them farewell. They watched him tramp off through the forest.
"First person to speak up in this town," Buck muttered. "About time, too."
They found Neil Howitt after another mile or so, checking one of his traps.
"Good afternoon," Buck called out. "Any luck with the trapping?"
The man looked up, startled. His eyes narrowed.
"No. What's your business here?"
Bob held up his badge. "Constable Fraser, RCMP, and this is Constable Frobisher. We're here to investigate the death of Jim Pitsiolik." No use trying to dissemble. The whole town knew why they were here by this time. Neil nodded shortly. It seemed like he wasn't about to contribute any information.
"Did you kill him?" Buck asked.
"I killed a wolf," Neil said. "He was threatening me, showing his teeth, probably after the hare in my trap. How was I to know it was one of them shifters, eh? He's got himself to blame, if you ask me." It sounded like a story he had told before. Jim was dead, and there was no way to know if the story was true or not. Maybe it was time to try another tack. "You say he was after the hare," Bob said, accepting Neil's story for now. "We've heard people say the shifters are taking game from the traps. Do you think it's true?"
"Oh, sure. I've seen it. Just the legs left in the trap, gnawed bloody, and the prints of a wolf leading away, bigger than you ever saw on a real wolf. It's them for sure."
Neil was growing expansive, gesturing with his mitten-clad hands to indicate the size of the tracks. Bob nodded, playing along.
"And there's been less game caught lately?"
"Yeah, it's the worst year in decades. We're all feeling it." Neil shook his head. Time to call his bluff, if it was a bluff. Maybe they should have waited to get all the facts, but Bob was going on his gut. Well, his gut and what that hunter had told them. He glanced at Buck to warn him, then said, "Then how come you've caught more game this year than anyone else, and more than you've ever done before?" Neil opened his mouth and said nothing. He cleared his throat.
Bingo.
Then his eyes shifted, focusing somewhere behind Bob, and he smiled unpleasantly. The hairs on Bob's neck prickled, and he whirled as quickly as one could whirl on snowshoes. Two men were standing there, holding them at gunpoint.
At the side path where the men had turned, Carolyn pretended to drop an onion. Stooping down, she sniffed the snow. Not much of a trail, and others had walked there as well. Still, it was something. She walked on to Rita's house and put the groceries down beside the door as quietly as she could. Listening, she heard her mother and Susan in a loud discussion. Good, they wouldn't have heard her. Carolyn sneaked off again, stooping down when she passed the windows so they wouldn't see her. It was dusk, and the moon was rising, almost full. She could feel it singing in her blood, and it mixed with the excitement of the chase. No one was going to hurt her mate, not if she could help it. She didn't have a plan, not really, but there had to be something she could do. If nothing else, she was sure she could follow those men in the dusk without being seen. And after all, it wasn't the first time she got mixed up in one of Bob and Buck's cases. No one was in sight as she turned aside to follow the two men. She passed a couple of cabins, giving them a wide berth, and examined the tracks leading out. Theirs were easy enough to find, as there were the fresh prints of a dog with them, and she slipped behind a spruce to undress, tucking the clothes underneath the skirt of branches. She slipped into wolf shape easily. This was her time.
The moon overhead was full and round, and almost as bright as day to her sensitive eyes. Silent as a shadow, she tracked the men. She was lucky. They were upwind of her, and the dog wouldn't smell her. She could soon see the men ahead. One of them turned to say something to the other, and she froze, caught between the urge to flee and the urge to attack. But he didn't see her. She dropped back and slowed down her pace, more cautious now. Through the trees, Carolyn heard the sound of voices. There, was that? Yes, it was. Bob was there, and Buck. Her heart beat faster, and she wanted to rush ahead. Patience. She had to have patience, or she would be discovered. She had to stalk them as carefully as she might a grazing deer, step by step. But then things happened very quickly. The men rushed forward and raised their guns. The dog barked. There was talking in loud, angry voices. The guns. It was the guns that were dangerous, not the gestures or noises or anything else. And she followed their movements intently and crept closer. One of the men raised his weapon, and she leapt up, knocking him into the other man. They both went down in a heap beneath her, and she snarled, snapping at the arms that tried to fend her off. But then another furry body slammed into hers, barking furiously. They rolled over in the snow, and Carolyn desperately tried to find her footing. She twisted away from the teeth that sought her neck, and snapped her own jaws together, trying for the throat, but slashing open the shoulder instead. The taste of blood filled her mouth. Dimly, she was aware that other things were happening around her, but the dog was rushing her again. She tried to leap to the side, but he caught her squarely in the flank, and she yelped as the air was knocked from her lungs. He was above her, and she twisted to protect her vulnerable belly. As she did so, there was a sharp pain in her head. But it only enraged her, and she snarled and tried again to reach his throat. She would kill him. A gunshot. For a moment, she stiffened in alarm, and so did her opponent. Then another gunshot, and there was blood on the snow. Bob forced himself to remain calm in the face of the guns. It was all in the confidence, and he even smiled a little, letting the men think he was cool as a cucumber. And deep down, he supposed he did think he'd get away with it all. After all, he'd had a gun pointed at him dozens of times and survived. He was young, and he wasn't going to die yet. "Come now, you don't think you're going to shoot a Mountie," he said. "You got no call to go meddling in our business," one of the men said, raising his gun threateningly. "Of course we do. It's our job. We're just trying to see justice done." Buck stood almost back to back with him, watching Neil Howitt. 2 against 3? It wasn't impossible odds. He kept talking, eyeing their opponents for possible signs of weakness. "How do you think you'll get away with it? Constable Wright knows where we are. He's sure to miss us." "Well, you're going to die, after all, so I might as well tell you." This was Neil Howitt, behind him, and the skin on Bob's neck crawled. But he knew Buck had his back, and he shook it off. "Remember that game you asked me about, from the other trap lines?" Neil continued. "The game everyone thought was taken by the shifters? Well, let's just say my friend's dog there won't mind tearing your throat out after we shoot you." Of course, that was how it had been done. The two men in front of Bob raised their guns, getting ready to shoot. Maybe he could rush them? No, they were too far away. If he tried, they'd gun him down while he ran. Time slowed while he looked into the muzzles of the guns. So this was it, after all. He was going to die here. In that instant, he fully believed it. Then a gray shape, blurred with speed, slammed into the two men, knocking them over in the snow. Bob didn't question his luck, but instantly seized the advantage, rushing forward. The men's dog was attacking the gray creature. What was it? Another dog? And they were rolling around in the snow. But he had no time to spare for looking at the fighting dogs. Bob grabbed hold of one man's gun, using it as a bludgeon to hit him on the head, and kicked the other man's gun away. Then, as the other man tried to rise, Bob aimed his own service revolver at him, trusting it more than the other man's gun. Belatedly, he wondered about Neil Howitt, but then he heard Buck's voice. "Bob, you all right?" "Right as rain," Bob said. There was the clicking sound of cuffs being closed somewhere behind him. "Keep the gun on your man, and I'll come and cuff him, too," Buck said. As he did so, Bob turned to see what had become of the dogs. They were fighting still, and there were bloody marks on the snow. The dog the men had brought was large and black, and the other dog, the one that had saved them, was a light gray and not much smaller. They were moving fast, and he couldn't quite make them out.
but there was something about that second dog. He frowned. Then suddenly he knew. Bob thought his heart might stop. He acted without thought, firing his gun in the air. The two fighting shapes stopped for an instant, and in that instant he shot the black dog. Its blood colored the snow red. Had he killed it? He couldn't bring himself to care. Bob was just about to rush to Carolyn's side, call out to her, anything, when Buck elbowed him sharply in the ribs. "Bob," he said in an undertone, "pull yourself together, man." Then he turned to Neil, who was lying cuffed in the snow. "Lucky thing my dog followed us, eh? Or maybe not so lucky for you." He whistled and called out, "Kiki, come here." Carolyn stood up. Her ear was bleeding, dripping blood on the snow. Bob watched, struck dumb, as she blinked, and then responded to Buck's call. He'd never been entirely sure how much human thought remained when she was in her wolf shape. But apparently it was enough for her to grasp Buck's intent. To see her sitting there at Buck's side was almost more than Bob could bear. He'd almost exposed her. Would have, if Buck hadn't been so quick-witted. Perhaps she'd have been better off with him after all. Neil's voice shook Bob out of his self-recrimination. "Looks like a wolf to me." "Half-wolf, I think," Buck said, shrugging. "One of my bitches got loose when she was in heat." He scratched Carolyn's ear, the one that wasn't bleeding. "Good dog. We'll get that ear patched up." They made it back to town, but Bob didn't remember much of how they managed, especially with three suspects, one of them injured. All he could think about was why on earth Carolyn was here at all. How had she gotten mixed up in this business? Bob felt a chill running down his spine. If she hadn't gotten mixed up in it, he wouldn't be alive to wonder. Carolyn hadn't understood Buck's plan at once, intent as she had been on the fight. But she had known Buck's voice. He wasn't one of her pack, but still, she trusted him, and went to him when he called. And then, when she saw the men lying in the snow and heard them speak, an instinctive wariness took over. They made her want to turn her ears down flat and show her teeth in a growl. She didn't. Neither did she rush to Bob to reassure herself with sight and smell and touch that he was all right. Instead, the instinct of survival took over, and in this case, survival required neither fight nor flight, but being crafty. So she let Buck scratch her ear and call her a good dog, although her skin crept with uneasiness at being so close to the men who had wanted to kill her mate. Returning to the town, she could not slink away without the prisoners noticing. So Carolyn continued to play the obedient dog, trotting along at Buck's heels on the main street of Aklavik. Bob said something to Buck as they got closer to the house where Carolyn could smell the dog teams, and Buck took the prisoners inside. Bob called to Carolyn and went around the back of the house. The dogs began to bark, and Bob shouted at them. They quieted down, and Carolyn showed her teeth at them. She might smell of blood and wolf to them, but they were just dogs. Besides, they were tied up. Bob kneeled down in the snow and took her head between his hands. "What are you doing here? Why? You almost..." She understood his words if she focused. But most of all, it was the tone in his voice and the grip of his hands that she responded to, and she licked his face. He let her, and caressed her head, carefully avoiding the painful ear. "Well, I suppose I won't get any answers out of you like this," Bob said. "Come back here when you've changed, all right?" Carolyn woofed in reply. It was dark, and she got out of town and made a large circle around it to avoid the houses and humans. She found her way to the spruce where she had left her clothes. With the ease of the full moon overhead, she slipped into human shape again. Shivering, she pulled her clothes on. The full impact of what had happened seemed to strike her with the cold, and she found her hands trembling slightly as she tied her boots. When she touched the side of her head, her fingers came away bloody. Carolyn took a deep breath. She sucked the blood off her fingers and started for Rita's house. When she got there, only Rita was home. "Where on earth have you been? We were worried sick. Your mother and Susan are out looking for you. And what's happened to you? You're all bloody." Carolyn made a face. Her mother was not going to be pleased. "They've got him," she said. "Bob and Buck, that is. They've got Neil Howitt, and I don't think he'll get out of it this time." "What? How do you know that?" "I was with them," Carolyn said. But before she got a chance to explain further, her mother nudged the door open and went straight for Carolyn, not even stopping to shake the snow off. Carolyn instinctively sat down on the floor.
Shifters in wolf shape mostly didn't like it when you stood up to look down on them, and alphas even less so. Her mother began to lick her face, almost bowling her over with the force of it. She found the bloody ear and growled slightly, licking it clean with an attention to detail that made Carolyn bite her lip with pain. Then, as Carolyn knew she would, her mother shifted. No wolf could say the things that she wanted to say, and before she even got her clothes on, she said, "Where have you been? Who has hurt you?" Her tone was sharp and worried. Carolyn drew a deep breath. Of course, she could lie and say she hadn't gone off on her own, but that would come back to bite her later. "I went after Bob and Buck. They were in danger." "What? You could have gotten yourself killed." The sharpness in her mother's voice was anger now. Carolyn set her jaw in a stubborn way that her mother might have recognized if she had been in a mood to do so, and she told her story. Her aunt came in while she was telling it, and she had to start over, while her mother and aunt interrupted with questions. When she'd gotten the whole story out, more or less, her mother said, in an ominous tone, "Why did you go off by yourself like that? You should have come back to tell us about it." "It was my maid in danger," Carolyn said. "Don't say you wouldn't go off by yourself if father was in danger." "That's different. I'm your mother, and you're still living under my roof." "But I won't always be. I'm getting married soon." Carolyn glared at her mother, and she glared back. Susan said, "You've got to let go sometime, Anne." The glare was turned on Susan, but then her mother huffed out a sigh and muttered, "Well, I don't have to like it. She's growing up so fast." She turned back to Carolyn. "Besides, that was rash, and you know it." To anyone else but her mother, Carolyn would probably have admitted it. Rita came over to wash Carolyn's ear with peroxide. She didn't seem to trust wolf spit on a wound, and bandage it. She said quietly, "Are you sure he won't get away with it? Neil Howitt, I mean." "I'm sure. I heard him confess. And besides, they were trying to kill two Mounties. No way would they get away with that." "Good." There was a vindictive gleam in Rita's eyes. Carolyn had promised, well, in her head she had, to come back to the detachment, and she didn't want Bob and Buck to worry about her. So despite the lateness of the hour, she borrowed Rita's heavy parka again to head out into the cold. "Well, all right, but I'm coming with you," her mother said. "Time enough to be worried now," her aunt muttered, which earned her an annoyed look. "All right," Carolyn said. She knew when to give way and when to insist, and this didn't really matter. The night was clear, and she felt the cold more than she did as a wolf. Carolyn drew her scarf up over her nose so that the cold air wouldn't sting her nostrils. Her mother walked beside her. They were both silent, but still, it wasn't an oppressive silence. With her mother, it was always best to have things out in the open. The detachment looked closed down and dark, except for one room in the back which had a lamp burning in the window. Carolyn took off her mitten and knocked on the glass. At once, Bob's face appeared in the window, and he jerked his thumb towards the front door. "You came back," he said when he opened the door, sounding relieved. Then he saw her mother, which he clearly hadn't expected. He made an aborted gesture with his hand, as if to take off a non-existent hat. "Mrs. Pinsent?" "I've told you. Call me Anne." She had told him to do that before, but Carolyn didn't think he ever would. "Come in, please." He stepped back to let them in. Buck poked his head out of the back room. "Oh, there you are. Glad you're all right." Bob threw a glance at Buck, and something clearly passed between them. Then Buck said, "Mrs. Pinsent, can I offer you some tea and biscuits?" She hesitated, but politeness won out. "Thank you. That would be nice." Carolyn followed Bob into the back room, while Buck engaged her mother in conversation. Carolyn suppressed a smile. She had to admit that was good teamwork. No wonder they worked well as partners. Once inside the room, though, Bob's serious expression took the smile off her face. "What were you doing out there? Why are you in Aklavik at all?" She told him the whole story, but carefully didn't reveal the identities of the shifters of Aklavik. That wasn't her secret to tell. "Don't tell your mother so, but that was a bit of a harebrained scheme," he said when she had finished. "What if you'd gotten shot when you got close to Aklavik?" "What, and you're never in danger? What about you almost getting yourself shot out there?" "That's different. It's part of my job," he began, but then he trailed off. He bit at his bottom lip. "You saved my life," he finally muttered, "and Buck's." They were standing some distance apart, and Carolyn couldn't help but compare that to how he had held her close and taken her head between his hands when she was a wolf. She stepped closer and put her hand up to his cheek, which was rough with stubble. He put his arms around her and hugged her, so hard that she almost lost her breath. "I thought you... when I saw you," he whispered into her ear. Her nose was in his neck, and with her strong sense of smell she drew in the scent of smoke and sweat and wool and him. "Yes," she murmured, hugging him back just as hard. He was only a little bit taller than she was, and she turned her head to kiss him. His lips met hers and parted. She tilted her head to deepen the kiss, and he made a small sound and pressed closer. Carolyn felt a rush of warmth run through her. Then she heard her mother's voice behind the closed door. She reluctantly pulled apart from Bob and glanced at the door meaningfully. He nodded, although he was looking as flushed as she felt. She cleared her throat. Should we... Well, I suppose so, he said. Carolyn smoothed her hair back, and they went out into the front room. Buck raised his eyebrows at them meaningfully, and Bob glared at him. Are you leaving now? Carolyn asked, to distract them. I mean, now that you've solved the case. Buck nodded. I think so. The local detachment can take it from here. Besides, we should get back to our ordinary patrols, or we'll hear about it from our sergeant, Bob added. And you? Carolyn glanced at her mother, who put down her teacup. Yes, we'll have to make sure Rita is all right, that is, Jim's widow, but then we'll be going home. Neither of the men asked how they would get home. Well, we'll be seeing you then, Bob said politely. Carolyn wanted to kiss him again. She smiled at him, hoping he would see it in her eyes. She couldn't wait until they were married. This has been a reading of Packmates by Luzula. For more of the author's work, visit archiveofourown.org/users/Luzula. Into the Wild, a Due South story by Luzula, read by Helen78. The white of the snow was almost unbroken now that the trail had climbed above the tree line, so that the dark shape lying ahead of me drew the eye immediately. So this was as far as she had made it. I had been tracking her for some time, ever since my detachment had received the news of a murder suspect on the run. She had fled across the border from Alaska in a light airplane, and the airplane was forced down by bad weather. The pilot had made it down to Haines Junction, but he said he'd lost his passenger. She had fled into the mountains on foot, or he had abandoned her. I'd taken a snowmobile at once. She was a wanted fugitive. But more, she was alone in the mountains, probably without any proper equipment, and would likely die soon if no one found her. Granted, the wind had died down, but the cold alone would kill her. I'd found the airplane, mostly unharmed, but mired in the snow. The metal skeleton of it had looked fragile and abandoned, and no one was there. Her trail had been easy to make out, her steps sinking deeply into the soft snow. It had led away to the north, toward Fortitude Pass. I had left the snowmobile and continued on snowshoes. I would have made better time if I'd shifted, of course, but I was on duty. I couldn't abandon myself to the instincts of a wolf, which was all too likely if I left my uniform and all the tools of a human behind. And anyway, there was no need. In just a pair of boots, she would be slow, and I would soon catch up with her. I had followed her trail until it rose above the last straggling trees. The wind-blown snow was packed harder here, and carried her weight without giving way. But her strength must have given out, or the cold taken her, because there she lay. The trail had ended, and there was nothing left for me to do but bring her body home. But it wasn't her. When I drew closer, I saw that what I had taken for a body was only a pile of clothes. I bent down and looked through them. A woefully inadequate coat, a pair of jeans, a shirt, a pair of boots, even underwear. Away from the pile led the unmistakable paw prints of a wolf. I straightened, feeling almost lightheaded. She was one of my own, a shifter. I hadn't known many of them in my life. Wolves are mostly loners, except to their own pack. My mother, of course, had been packed to me, but she had been dead for many years. And Quinn, who had taught me what it was to be a shifter, I had left behind to join the RCMP. Since then, I had been walking a fine line between repression and the need to hide what I was, and the equal need of freedom for my other self. That she was a shifter changed nothing. It was still my duty to bring her in. No doubt she felt herself safe as a wolf. Her tracks were light on the packed snow, and would be hard to track for an ordinary human. But I wasn't an ordinary human. Crouching down, I put my nose to the snow. Her scent was there, faint, but clear. I would be slower than she was, but I still refused to shift. If I did, we would be two animals, not an officer of the law and a wanted fugitive. Fortunately, I had taken enough supplies for several days. I packed her clothes and boots in my backpack. She would need them if she shifted back into human shape. Then I adjusted the straps of my pack so that it sat more securely on my shoulders and went on, making good time on the hard snow. The land rose in steep curves, the kind of uphill slope where one thinks one is about to reach the top, but it's always just the summit of another foothill. I knew Fortitude Pass lay ahead of me, but I was caught in the details of the landscape. On a map, or from a plane, it all looks so clear, but on foot one only sees the shifting hues of white, broken by the sharp black of rock. High above the peaks, the sky was hazy with cirrus clouds, the ends of them upturned like the tip of a ski. Bad weather coming in. I still went on. Toward evening, I was high up under the pass, and the valley I had left lay underneath me. The trees were spread like a dark cape over the feet of the mountains, and the sun was sinking into a snarl of heavy clouds. The wind was picking up, softening the contours of the slopes with drifting snow. I tightened the hood of my parka. Her trail, which I had only been following with difficulty, would soon be entirely lost. But luck led me to her, luck and the nocturnal habits of wolves. A little way ahead of me, I saw suddenly a dark head poking out from a snowdrift on the sheltered side of an outcrop, and then she emerged, shaking herself vigorously. Sure of her escape, she had grown careless and slept during the day. I drew my service revolver and aimed it at her. "Stop! Victoria Metcalf, you are under arrest." Her head turned and she froze. I could hardly miss her at this range, even through the rising wind. I stared her in the eye and made myself believe that I would shoot her if she moved. My body language must have conveyed it at least, because she didn't move. I moved nearer until we were looking into each other's eyes. Hers were a warm brown, and she followed my every movement with the utmost attention. No wonder I was holding a gun on her. I saw the moment when she realized what I was. The wind was behind me and carried my scent to her. Her nostrils quivered, and then she started in surprise, pricking her ears forward. The storm came fully on us then, and I stumbled and almost fell with the sudden force of it. There was no question of reaching Haines Junction that day, and no danger of her escaping from me, for that matter. Not even a wolf could travel in this weather. We both cowered down behind the outcrop, small creatures pinned down by the impersonal fury of the storm. "I'm going to change," I shouted to her, to be heard over the wind. Indeed, I would have to if I were to survive. I took off my snowshoes and stepped into the hole where she had slept. It was a deep snowdrift, and I sank down to my thighs. I stamped out a larger hole and set up my backpack to further block the wind. Quickly and methodically, I stripped off my clothes. The wind chill was instantly numbing, and my body shivered violently in a vain attempt to stay warm. Changing was a relief. None of that bare, helpless flesh anymore, but claws and thick fur. She looked at me, ears flattened back by the wind or by suspicion, but I moved to one end of the hole and she came down beside me. It didn't seem to matter so much anymore why we were here. She was a warm body, in a place where everything was cold, and we burrowed further into the snow together. Snow covered us, and we lay there for a night and a day. In the darkness, I learned her sounds and her smells. Her ribcage rose and fell with her warm breath. She had a cut on one paw, and I licked it clean, learning her taste. Mostly we slept, curling up close together for warmth. I woke up hungry in the evening of the second day. Dimly, I remembered something about emergency food in my backpack, but it was human food in plastic bags. Plastic wasn't good to eat. I wanted meat. I poked my head up through the snow and found that the wind had almost died down. She stirred too, jumping out and shaking herself thoroughly, from her head to the tip of her bushy tail. Pieces of melted and refrozen snow still stuck to her fur in places, and she leaned over to worry at them with her nose. I jumped out too, looking at the newly swept landscape.
"Hunt?" she said, turning her ears forward.
"Yes," I said. We left the hole in the snow without a backward glance, all our senses alert for game. There was none on the open snow, and my belly rumbled with hunger. Later in the night, we found a deer down among the trees. It was old, and we brought it down together, tearing at its haunches until it bled out and fell. We tore into it ravenously, and the taste of its blood on my tongue was satisfying. I filled my belly, and so did she. I settled down beside her and licked her coat where it was spattered with blood. "We hunt well together," she observed, and it was true. I lay down my head on her flank, feeling content. Food in my belly, a companion beside me, fields of snow that waited for my footprints. I had a vague sense that if I'd been human, this would be something I disapproved of. I flicked my ear, dismissing the complications of humans. There were so many things my human self thought I shouldn't do. We slept, and ate again, and stayed in the forest for some time. But she wanted to move on, and we climbed the pass again, chasing each other playfully up the slopes. The outcrop where we'd rested last time was a known place, and we stopped there to rest. The human things I'd left there were snowed over, and I pawed at the snow, digging them out. It was as if I'd left my human self there as well. Clothes, boots, backpack. I sniffed at the fur lining on the parka. Then I saw the red of my uniform. Red. It caught my mind like the red of blood, just as compelling, but different. It tugged at the human part of me like a fish caught on a line. My God, what was I doing? I had no idea how many days I had spent as a wolf with her. Perhaps it was just one or two, but it could have been a whole week. I've no doubt that had she been in heat, we would have mated, and come summer we might have had cubs together in some den in a sunny hillside. No, I was human. With an effort, I wrenched myself from my wolf body and changed. Almost immediately, I started shivering, and I pulled my cold clothes on, shaking off the snow as best I could. She was standing beside me, tail lowered uncertainly. Although I was human enough now to feel embarrassment that she had seen me naked, she showed no sign of it. She whined quizzically. Victoria Metcalf was a murder suspect, I reminded myself. I would have to turn her in. There was nothing else I could do. Nothing else, I repeated to myself, as if the slightest deviation from duty would mean complete dissolution of my morals and my humanity. Victoria, I have your clothes here. I took them out of my backpack. Will you shift? She blinked at me and sat down on the snow. Her eyes were clear and brown and purely wolf. I looked down into them, trying to find the human being that I knew was there. It happened sometimes that shifters lost themselves and couldn't change back. If that's the case, then surely it wouldn't hurt to... No. Please. I took her head between my hands. I know you're there. She shook herself a little, then began to tremble. Her front legs stretched out to become pale arms, and black hair surrounded her face in a wild tangle. Her eyes were still brown. She was the most beautiful woman I had ever seen. She was also naked, and I turned away, blushing, as she dressed herself. Victoria Metcalf? Yes. Her voice was hoarse, as if she hadn't used it in a while. I'm Benton Fraser. I felt strange introducing myself, because we knew each other already. We had run through the forest together, understanding each other without words. But now we were humans, and I had no idea what she was thinking behind that beautiful face. Royal Canadian Mounted Police, I added reluctantly. Her face grew hard and suspicious. I wondered whether it was her human self coming back, or if it was the hostility of a cornered wolf. And what? What are you going to do with me? I'm afraid I'll have to bring you in. Why? Why can't you leave me here? No one will know you found me. I can't do that. I'm sorry. Will you come with me? Or what? She said, addressing the implicit threat in my words. I was stronger than she was. I had a gun.
I had training in physical violence. We both knew that.
No, don't answer that. I'll come with you.
I shouldered the pack, and we headed down towards the abandoned airplane and the snowmobile I had left beside it. It should have been an easy walk, downhill and over packed snow, in bright sunlight, but my feet were heavy. Partly it was that feeling I always had after changing, of plodding along ridiculously slowly on two legs, but it was more than that. Victoria kept pace with me, not speaking. When we reached the softer snow in the forest, I unstrapped my snowshoes from the pack and gave them to her. She shrugged and accepted them. The spruce trees wrapped themselves in shadow as darkness fell, as deep as the silence between us. There was no moon yet, but the sky was clear and rich with stars. Every time I breathed in, the cold air stung my nostrils. It was full dark when we reached the airplane, and my legs ached from walking in the deep snow. I broke the silence first. "We'll have to stay here overnight. It's too dark to drive safely." Victoria didn't reply, and I rummaged in my backpack for a flashlight. There should be... Ah, yes. In the back of the airplane, I found emergency supplies, including two heavy blankets. We needed food and hot fluids, so I took off my mittens and set up my small portable stove, pumping up the pressure in the gasoline flask. Carefully, I primed the burner and waited until it began to hiss, burning with a steady blue flame. Somehow this lightened my heart a little. The cheerful light of the stove and the noise it made had often been my only companion in the wilderness. I scooped up snow in a pan and set it to melting. I glanced up at Victoria's face. I couldn't read her at all. She might as well have been a statue. Painfully, I remembered how we had played on the mountain slopes, rolling around and mock-biting each other. Here. I gave her pemmican, a handful of dried fruit, and a mug of tea. She ate hungrily, and so did I. When we had finished, I took out my sleeping bag and laid it out side by side with the blankets on the floor of the cargo space in the airplane. We were still warm from the hiking, and it wouldn't do to wait until we were cold before we went to bed. I indicated that she take the sleeping bag, which was warmer, and she did so with a wry twist of her lips.
"Now you're being chivalrous."
I said nothing to that, because there was nothing I could say. I wondered if she would try to escape in the night, but I was a light sleeper, and I would hear the airplane door opening. Strangely, I wasn't afraid that she would try to kill me. In the darkness, I heard the rustling of the sleeping bag as she turned over. I was tired, but not sleepy, and the sound of her breathing seemed loud to me. When she spoke, her voice was low but sure, as if she was telling a story she knew the words of by heart. "He didn't know about me at first. He said he loved me, and I believed him. But then he caught me changing, and it was like I didn't know him anymore. He was drunk, and he took a bottle, and I was caught in the corner. I don't remember what I did, but there was blood." I lay there and listened, and I thought of my mother, who had been shot down as a wolf. "It was self-defense, then?" "Yes," Victoria whispered. "Please, let me go. In that case, you have nothing to be afraid of. Just tell the truth, and the court will listen to you." I had to believe that was true. My mother's killer had gone free, but surely society had changed since then. "I'll help you, I promise. I'll do anything I can."
"Except let me go."
"Yes, I'm sorry. I can't do that." I could hear Victoria move beside me, turning her back. Sleep was slow in coming to me, and my thoughts chased themselves in circles. I was almost asleep when I felt her shift closer to me. Her hand reached out, and the press of it against my chest shocked me, even through my clothes and two layers of blankets. I lay absolutely still while she began to speak again. Her voice this time was barely a whisper, breaking off and beginning again. "We could stay here." Her hand stroked across my chest. "Go deeper into the mountains. No one would find us." My eyes were closed, and in the darkness I remembered running. I remembered her warm fur and her heart beating close to mine as we rested. We hunt well together. I could hear her heart beating now, a quick flutter too low for anyone other than a shifter to hear. "How can you live like this?" She tugged at the collar of my uniform. "It's like a leash." Her hand moved up to my stubbled cheek, light and tentative, and I turned my head to the side to touch my lips to her fingers. They were warm, despite the cold around us. I licked them, and she tasted somehow of home, though I didn't know exactly where that was. "Don't you want to be free of it all? All those human things?" She sounded bitter. "Yes," I whispered. "Sometimes." Then I reached out in the darkness to do something very human. I kissed her, bringing my chapped lips awkwardly against her cheek, and then her mouth. For a moment we both lay still, and our warm breath mingled in the cold air. Then she tilted her head, and her hand took hold of the back of my neck. My mouth opened for her, and her tongue slid against mine. She tasted of pemmican and tea. It was strange how that small point of contact between us could so affect my whole body. I felt as if I should be glowing, lit up from the inside by desire. Breathing hard, I fought my hand free of the blankets and tucked her closer. My fingers dug down underneath her scarf and coat to find the warm, soft skin of her neck. "Come with me," she murmured against my mouth. "Please." I brought our mouths together again because I didn't trust myself to speak. Slowly, slowly, I fought myself down. This wasn't for me. It was none of it for me. And I should take my hands off her. I let go of her neck, then took her hand in mine and brought it away from me. "Victoria," I breathed, but then couldn't deny her. "Not yet. Let it wait until the morning." Instead, I pulled her close to me and buried my face in her hair. When I slept, I dreamed of running in the snow. It was dusk, and I knew Victoria was there with me. Only I could not see her. She was somewhere in front of me or behind me. Sometimes I caught a glimpse of her gray fur, half hidden by drifting snow, and I chased after her. Or was she the one chasing me? Finally, I sat down and howled in frustration and longing. I woke at dawn, the light filtering in through the dirty windows of the airplane. Victoria was still sleeping, her cheek pressed against my shoulder as if she trusted me. I felt terrible. I stared up at the curved bare metal above me until I finally found the strength to do what I must. Shaking her gently, I said, "Victoria, wake up." She stirred, then opened her eyes. I looked into them, and I think she saw what I was going to say before I said it. "I'm sorry," I said. Her mouth twisted bitterly. We ate breakfast, back in the silence that had lain between us yesterday. Sometimes she tensed, as if considering an escape, but I kept a sharp eye on her. Indeed, my eyes were drawn to her for entirely different reasons, and I found it hard to look away. Her black hair was unkempt, and I wanted to run my fingers through it and work the snarls out. But I didn't. Inexorably, time passed. We finished our meal, and I packed my things, and there was no longer any excuse not to leave. I started the snowmobile, and the deep growl of its motor cut through the silence of the woods. We left for the detachment at Haines Junction. Victoria was extradited to Alaska to be put on trial in Juneau. I followed her there to offer my help, as I had promised. When I visited her in prison before the trial, she looked pale and somehow smaller than before, with her hair drawn back severely. "Please, tell me how I can help you. Do you have a good lawyer?" "I don't need more of your help," she said, with a sarcastic emphasis on help that made me flush. "I promised you I would." "Yeah, well, I want you to leave. I mean it." She stared into my eyes with a feral desperation. I left. Nevertheless, I kept myself informed about the trial. I'd been the arresting officer, and I suppose that explained my interest in the case. Victoria's lover had been abusive even before he knew that she was a shifter. The dry prose of the courtroom secretary gave me the neighbor's testimony. Sounds overheard from their apartment on the weekend nights. Bruises glimpsed on Victoria's body. She had not told me this, and I tried to see what lay behind the words she didn't say. I pictured her beaten, mute, until she finally struck back. Eventually, Victoria was convicted. My hopes that the prejudice against shifters had changed since the days of my mother's trial were evidently unfounded. When I read the prosecutor's closing speech, I felt nauseous. I wondered how she would live in prison. Would she suppress the change, curled into a ball in her cot at night and clenching her teeth against the pull of the full moon? Or would she give in and scratch with her claws in vain at the door of her cell? I shuddered. I couldn't imagine living like that. She would be shut up in a box a few square feet in size, denied the sky and the trees and the smell of the earth. I cried for her and mourned her as if she were dead. In Chicago, I lived undercover, as I always had, but this time it was more. I was undercover not only as an ordinary human, but as a Canadian. The advantage was, I suppose, that no one even came close to suspecting my secret. They were too distracted by my bright red coat and by my other peculiarities. The disadvantage of this was having no one to truly talk with, but I was used to that. Besides, I had Diefenbaker, of course. I also had Ray Vecchio, loudmouthed and loudly dressed, but loyal in a way I hadn't encountered in a long time. He was my partner and my friend, and I was grateful to have him. I wondered sometimes what he would think if he knew that every month at the full moon I and Diefenbaker would get ourselves to a forest, slink into the shadows, and live for a night as wolves. It was so much less than what we really needed, but we got by. Perhaps Ray might not shun me after all. To him, it might be only another of the strange things I did, and he would shake his head affectionately and accept it. But the habit of secrecy kept my mouth closed, and I said nothing to him. The first time I saw her in Chicago, I thought I had imagined it. It was only a glimpse, a flash of gray fur behind a dumpster in an alley. I suppose you might think one wolf is like another, and there isn't much to tell the difference. Or you might think it was far likelier that it hadn't been a wolf at all, but only a dog. But I knew her. I knew the line of her legs, the hint of reddish brown on her muzzle, and the way she held her ears. In a brief moment, I felt the city fade around me, as if the clutter of its buildings was not the real world at all, but only a screen of some kind. The real world was one of trees behind trees, and the scent of imminent snow cold in my nose. Then I moved and bumped against the side of the dumpster. "Victoria," I called out, and ran around to where I had seen her. There was no one there, of course. I went down on my hands and knees to see if I could catch her scent. It was maddening. I thought I could smell something, but it might as well have been conjured up by my own mind. Whatever trail she might have left was drenched in the mingled odors of piss, gasoline, and the rotting remains of produce. I shook my head, huffing a breath out through my nose to clear it. Dief came trotting around the corner. "Do you smell anything?" I asked him. His senses were far sharper than mine were when I was human. "One of us?" I added, in a low voice. He went still, like a statue of a wolf, only the tip of his nose moving. Then he gave a sharp bark. My heart thumped almost painfully in my chest at the thought that I might not have imagined her. Abruptly, I began to run down the alley the way she must have gone. I ran, and at the next intersection, Dief turned right, and I followed him. People looked at us strangely, stepping out of the way, and when I went down on my knees to sniff at the pavement, they pretended to ignore us. But there was only the faintest trace of an imagined scent, and soon we lost even that. I closed my eyes and saw again trees. Snowflakes began to drift on the wind. We headed home. There was snow falling in my mind. I moved the fries on my plate around listlessly. I couldn't seem to put her out of my mind, and those few days were as clear to me, no, clearer, than the diner around me. I remembered the way her fur felt against my nose, and her breath coming in white clouds in the winter air. "You did the right thing, son. You did your duty. It's the only thing you could have done." My father appeared to be reading my mind. "She's the only woman I ever loved, and I put her in prison. Duty's a poor excuse." "She was a criminal. You had no choice but to bring her to justice." "Perhaps." My father reached over from the opposite seat and began to eat my abandoned fries. "Dad, did you ever wish that you were a shifter?" He looked surprised, as if it was a non sequitur. And perhaps it was. "Well, it doesn't seem to be doing you much good." "No, I suppose not. But my mother, I mean,
Didn't you ever feel...
You know, Buck used to tease me that my wife was a better hunter than I was. But I always said, well, the more meat, the better. He looked down at the fry in his hand and put it back on the plate.
She was a fine woman.
I nodded. I'm not even sure what I wanted to know. Perhaps if he had ever wished that he could run with her. Well, I should get going, son. Duty calling. He tipped his hat at me, and I refrained from asking what duties he had in the afterlife. I stared at the mostly full plate, then stood up to leave. As I turned toward the cash register to pay, I saw a glimpse of curly black hair in the corner of my eye. Cursing myself for a fool, I turned to look. It wasn't her, of course. I was seeing her on every street corner now. Except it was. It was her. I ran, out of the diner and past, over, through the cars that were in my way. They honked their horns at me, but I never noticed, desperate to catch sight of her again. Gone again. Perhaps I was going mad. Or perhaps there was another ghost haunting me. Of course, my father had never been so elusive, even though I might sometimes wish he was. The waiter was knocking on the window of the diner, waving a piece of paper in the air. Oh, of course. My bill. I went inside to pay, and when I turned to leave, there she was, so beautiful it felt like a stab to my gut. We spoke, and she was smiling at me. My hand brushed hers, and it was warm. Warm and solid and real. She wasn't a ghost. I wanted to touch her again. We shopped for groceries and then went to my apartment to cook like civilized people. Deef knew what she was, of course, and he followed her every moment with alert caution. Deef, it's all right. I know her. She's one of us, I said. He relaxed a little and sniffed her delicately. Victoria let him, holding out her hand. She looked elegant, beautiful, civilized. No one would ever think that she was a shifter, but I felt it. Her scent had just a hint of musk in it, and there was a fluidity to her movements that drew my eyes. I wanted her so much that it was an ache in my whole body. "How are you doing in the city?" she asked, when we were seated at the table, eating dinner. "Oh," I said, stalling. I was so used to not talking about the things that were important. This question might have been innocuous from anyone else, but not from her. "It's not easy, is it?" She stretched her hand out to touch mine. I shook my head. "So why are you here?" "I was stationed here. It's my duty." Her expression didn't change, and I didn't know how else to explain. Either she understood that, or she didn't. "Oh, Ben, you haven't changed. Neither have you." I wanted to ask her about her years in prison, but didn't. I wished we could shift. There would be no need for this hesitation, these frustrated human attempts at communication. After dinner, I walked Victoria to her hotel, and I wondered if I would ever see her again. But she came back. She stood there again outside my door, not long after she had left, and there was a bitterness in her eyes that reminded me of how she had looked when I turned her in. "Did you think we could pretend it didn't happen? How could you do it?" I couldn't stand her looking at me like that, and I felt sick to my stomach with guilt. I wrapped my arms around her and felt the tension vibrating in her body. She knotted her hands in my shirt, to push me away or to pull me close, I couldn't tell. "How could you do that to me, huh? How could you do it?" I kissed her, and it was like setting a match to wood doused with kerosene. Her hands dug into me fiercely, and her mouth met mine. I slid my hands into her hair, pulling her still closer. "Door," I thought, and spared a moment to slam it closed. Then we went toward my bed, trying to get into each other's clothes. It felt almost like giving in to the urge to change at full moon, as if I would emerge a different creature after this. I fell backwards onto the bed, with her weight on top of me. I spread my legs and rocked up against her, anything for more of the maddening pressure of her body against mine. Her fingers were against my skin, in my hair, in my mouth. She pulled my shirt over my head impatiently, half-trapping my arms. I tugged it off and pushed my hands in under her shirt and found her breasts. I wanted my mouth on them. She took off her shirt and brassiere, dropping them on the floor. I drew her down to suck on one of her nipples, and she moaned, sitting up again. Then she sat back, pinning my legs under her, and unbuttoned my jeans and tugged them down a little. When she took my erection in her hand, I gasped and tried again to pull her close to me.
but she stood up quickly to shed the last of her clothes. Then she straddled me and sank down on my erection with closed eyes, biting her lip. "Just like that?" I thought, surprised for a second. And then there were no coherent thoughts left. I took hold of her hips, thrusting slowly up, and she gasped. I looked up at her. Her face was partly shadowed by her hair, but I could see that her mouth was open and her eyes closed. Then I licked my thumb and put it down between her legs, searching, trying to make sure she felt the same pleasure as I did. She drew in a breath and shuddered, then tugged my arm away. "Lie still," she murmured, holding my arms down at the wrists. She moved on me, and I met her every movement with one of my own, until it felt impossible that I should last for one more. "Oh, please," I gasped. "Let me touch you. Let me kiss you." She leaned down and kissed me. It was rough, with teeth, but I didn't mind. My arms were free, and I held her tightly while I groaned and came inside her. She was all around me, her weight heavy on top of me, her hair in my face. I lay there, panting as if I had run for miles, while she slid off and lay beside me, stroking my chest. I didn't think she had come, though, and I propped myself up on one elbow to look down at her. I slid my hand up along her belly to hold her breast, and lowered my mouth to suck on it. This time she didn't interrupt me, and I took my time, feeling the tightness of her nipple under my tongue, circling and playing with it. When I finally looked up, there was a slight smile to her face, and her eyes were half closed. She drew one leg up in a clear invitation. I moved down to kneel on the floor and put my mouth on her there, too. I had never done this before, not with a woman, but the anatomy was clear to me, at least. With a feeling almost of reverence, I began licking, slowly and tentatively at first, but then with increasing confidence as I learned her reactions. My chin and nose were wet with her, and I wanted to do this forever. When she hitched her hips up demandingly, I slowed down, and she moaned in frustration. "Open, please. Please." The low, rough sound of her voice so excited me that I almost grew hard again. I reached up to take her nipples between my fingers and licked at her again and again. She gasped and shuddered, and I could feel her legs tense around me as she came. I kept my mouth there until she flinched and pushed me away. Suddenly shaky, I realized that I still had my jeans and underwear most of the way on. I took them off and came up onto the bed again, pulling the blanket over the both of us. She tensed a little when I held her close, but then she relaxed. "Victoria," I whispered, kissing the nape of her neck. "Victoria." On Saturday morning, I woke and realized that I needed to go out and buy food. We had stayed in the whole previous day, spending most of it in bed. Indeed, Victoria had tied my hands to it with my own lanyard and sucked me until I was incoherent. Deef had left us to our mating and charmed his way into a neighbor's apartment, where he was horribly pampered and fed with cookies. The world outside my apartment was as it had always been. Cars honking on the street, trash in the alleys, a group of teenagers on the corner smoking cigarettes. But I felt changed. The fingers that picked groceries from the shelves on the store were the same ones that had been deep inside her last night. We belonged to each other now, and nothing could change that. Lost in these thoughts, it took me a second to recognize what I smelled when I opened the door of the apartment again. Blood. Instantly, I was alert, but I couldn't quite make sense of what I saw. Ray on the floor, motionless and bleeding. "Ray!" I shouted. Distantly, I heard sirens. I went to my knees, trying to staunch the blood. Then I looked up again. "Victoria? Victoria!" There was no reply. Ray stirred feebly. "You missed my pool night," he whispered, and damn, that was true. I'd been too caught up in Victoria to remember. "I'm so sorry, Ray." But he was already out again. The door burst open, and two uniformed police officers came through. "Hands up!" "But..." One of them aimed a gun at me. "Hands up!" I held them up, red with blood. "I'm only trying to stop the bleeding." A paramedic came through the door. "We got a call from a neighbor who heard the screaming. Out of the way!" One of the police officers read me my rights. "But I'm..." Yeah, you might be innocent, I know. It's standard procedure." I knew that, yes. "This looks like an animal attack," the paramedic said, and I finally had to stop pretending. "Victoria, but why? How? What had happened?"
"Do you know anything about what happened here?" the officer asked me. I shook my head, dazed. "No." "Well, I'll bring you along to the station."
"Ray, let the professionals take care of it, okay?"
At the station, Huey clapped me on the back with sympathy in his eyes. "I'm so sorry, Fraser, but sometimes it happens. Animals can go crazy, and Deef's a wolf, not a dog. He's not meant to live in a city."
"Deef? But he's with the neighbors," I said, without thinking.
"He is? Well, we'll check that out." Huey frowned. "You sure you don't know anything about it? Ray was attacked in your apartment. You guys working a case that might have endangered him?" I shook my head mutely. In fact, I had no earthly idea what could have happened. I was carefully not thinking about the fact that I was withholding pertinent information from the police. Gardino came up to us, and he was looking strangely at me. "I was just on the phone, and we have an anonymous tip. It's kind of weird, though." I knew instinctively from the way Gardino looked at me what the tip had been, and there was only one person in Chicago who could have given it. I was cold suddenly, clammy with sweat, and I tried desperately to find some other explanation. "What's the tip?" Huey asked. "That Fraser's a shifter, and he went crazy and attacked Ray." Huey's eyebrows went up. "What? That's absurd." "Yeah, I know. But it's not like we have other leads at the moment, except for Deef." Gardino turned to me. "Fraser, I'm sorry. We'll have to check. But hey, it's not like we believe it, you know?" I nodded automatically. "Go down to Mort and give him a blood sample, okay?" They had to check, but no one took the accusations seriously yet. It would take a week or so to analyze the blood samples. I had until then before my life and career in the RCMP was ruined. Only I was sunk in a kind of fatalism. On some level, I supposed that it was fair. At the very least, there was an ironic kind of symmetry in my fate and Victoria's. I suppose that was why she had done it. I wanted desperately to see Victoria again, though I didn't know what I would say to her. At the earliest opportunity, I visited Ray at the hospital. He was pale, but conscious, and the bite wounds were less serious than the amount of blood on his clothes and on the floor had led me to believe. He had struck his head on the kitchen counter while falling, and was held under observation for concussion. "Hey, Benny," he said, smiling a little. "Ray," I said, and looked him in the eyes with an effort. "You have any idea what happened back there? 'Cause they tell me there's some weird-ass accusation against you, like you turn furry when there's a full moon or something." He looked at me steadily. I couldn't possibly lie to Ray while he lay there in a hospital bed, wounded on my account. Not that I had literally lied to anyone yet, but I owed Ray the truth. I swallowed. "Do you remember the woman in my apartment yesterday morning?" Ray had come by when I hadn't turned up at work, worried that I was sick. He'd been delighted and congratulated me when he discovered that I was getting laid, as he put it. Ray nodded. My tongue grew thick in my mouth, but I went on. The story wasn't easy in the telling, but I managed, finally, to get it out. Ray knew it all now. His first reaction wasn't one of revulsion or even surprise that I was a shifter, and I felt lightheaded with relief. "She was setting you up the whole time, fucking bitch." Incongruously, my mind inserted the thought that yes, she was indeed literally a bitch when she shifted. I felt like giggling hysterically, but I suppressed it. "I don't know. Perhaps she was," I said instead. "Sure she was. Where is she now? Do you know?" I shook my head. Could it all have been a lie? Was it possible to lie with your whole body? To lie when you were making love? There was a knock on the door. Huey and Welsh came in, and Welsh sat heavily down in the other guest chair. "Constable, I'm afraid we're going to have to arrest you." I bowed my head. "Fraser, don't do that. You're innocent," Ray said. Welsh sighed. "We're still waiting for news on the blood sample, but meanwhile we checked your apartment. There were traces of two different wolves in there." "Of course. And they weren't even her tracks." "Constable, I really am sorry. But there's pressure from above, and it'll be out of my hands if I don't do anything. The FBI agents who specialize in, well, shifters who run amok, got wind of the case. They say shifters sometimes turn schizophrenic and can't control their wolf side, especially in cities." "I'm sorry, Fraser," Huey said as he cuffed me. The cold metal closed around my wrists with a quiet snicking sound. "Wait," Ray said from the bed, and then winced as his gesture tugged at his wound. "Fraser,
Tell them about her. I'll do it if you don't. I didn't say anything, and Ray spoke instead. He told them about Victoria, but carefully omitted any mention of myself as a shifter. Ray was trying to offer me an out, and selfishly, I took it. Constable, is this true? Welsh said. I nodded. Ray came to let me out of prison the next day. He'd put together money for bail. I knew there was no way he could afford that, but he had still done it. At the station, Welsh met us with a somber face. Your Metcalf woman is dead, Constable, he said bluntly. She died in a car accident in Alaska. Vecchio, did you ever actually see this woman? Ray shook his head reluctantly. No, sir, I didn't. Fraser, we checked your apartment for fingerprints, and the only ones there were yours and Detective Vecchio's. I'm sorry. His voice was almost gentle. I felt dizzy and sat down abruptly on the nearest chair. For a moment, I considered the possibility that I was delusional, and that Victoria had only been a ghost conjured up by my loneliness, that I had attacked Ray and lost all memory of it. Then I remembered that Victoria had mentioned her sister dying in a car accident. I brought my hand up to my neck and fingered a bruise left there from our lovemaking. No, she was real, and I had to find her. That evening, I wandered the dark streets of Chicago with Deef at my side. I started at the dumpster where I had first seen her, but no one was there. I passed bars where loud music played in rhythms that vibrated in my bones and made Deef shake his head in irritation. I passed drunks who looked at me with unfocused eyes. I passed dark, abandoned parks. But I didn't see Victoria. Deef, do you smell anything? I asked, for what felt like the 100th time. Deef glanced up at me and licked my hand. I had come to another park, the edge of it sharply illuminated by street lamps. But the light quickly gave way to darkness and the indistinct, half-seen shapes of trees and bushes. Ben, said a low voice ahead. I stopped short as if she would run away if I made the slightest move. Victoria, I breathed. I could see the pale shape of her face and her hands. Even with my night vision, her hair and coat blended into the darkness around her. Her expression was sharp and intent, shadowed by leaves. You must really hate me for what I did, I said. Yeah, hate. Love. Those two emotions about cover it. What do you want, Victoria? You. No, you don't, I said. But my heart beat faster, as if I still believed it. Why do you think I did all of this? Revenge. Maybe. But I need you. I want you to go away with me. You know I can't do that, I said automatically. Why not? You don't have much to stick around here for, and you won't like prison. How did you survive it? I finally asked. She looked down, and her hair hid her face. There was a yard, grass, two maple trees. They locked me in that yard at full moon, and I learned every inch of that space. Once I tried to bite through the fence, but it hurt my teeth. You never told them about me. No. Why not? I thought about you when I was in there. You were free, still running. I'm not free, I wanted to protest. She met my eyes again, and her voice sharpened. Anyway, they know what you are now. Then meet me tomorrow night. She gave me an address. I didn't reply, and she didn't wait for me to do so. Instead, she took off her coat and let it fall to the ground. Underneath it, she was naked, her body pale except for the dark triangle of hair between her legs. But I only caught a glimpse of her. She was changing, blending into the night and slipping away. And then she was gone. I stood there for a long while, silent and confined in my clothes, before I went back to my apartment. It was a field on the outskirts of the city, the edges of it blending into abandoned industrial lots and the encroaching trees. It was dusk, and I pulled my leather jacket closer around me in the chill. Deef stood still beside me, ears forward and alert. I still didn't know why I had come to her, but I knew that I had to. There was a movement in the bushes, and there she was. She was a wolf, padding silently towards me, and I could not stop looking at her. I drank in the sight of her as if I had thirsted for days. 20 meters away, she paused. Victoria.
She gave a half-growl, half-whine, then turned towards the distant trees and pawed the ground. "Come with me." My mouth was dry, and I tried to swallow. "I can't," I said, although I could hardly say why any longer. There were reasons, but they were distant, and she was here. My senses were sharpening, reaching for her and the dusk and the dew falling on the grass. I wanted to shed my clothes and run. She began to walk away, and I stood still. Ray, my duty. Behind me, I heard cars coming closer, and I knew that they were coming for us. They'd had me followed, of course. I began moving towards her, and Deef moved by my side. She glanced back and barked, speeding up. I began to run, and with the running came a wild sense of joy. There would be no more hiding, no more complications. Within me, a new word trembled. Pack. We were a pack. Victoria turned back toward me, leaping up to welcome us home. "Watch out, she's attacking!" a voice behind me shouted, and hard on the heels of it there was a tremendous noise in my ears and in my body, a clamor of nerves and my legs faltering and the wet grass in my face. I felt Deef licking my face and whining. She was leaving me, running on without me. I tried to move my legs, but there was only pain and confusion, and then nothing. The ceiling was white. No, a light beige. This single piece of information floated around in my mind, and I felt peaceful and blank. "Benny," a voice said, trying to sound calm, but I could hear worry underneath. "Ray." I tried to turn my head, but the effort was too much. Then he was gone, or I was gone. The next time the angle of the sun was different. "Benny, you there?" "Yes." "Oh, thank God, I thought you were going to die." "So did I." I tried to clear my throat. "Could I have some water?" "Sure, just let me..." Ray tentatively tried to lift me up enough to drink until a nurse came in and helped me with cool, professional hands. Ray waited until the nurse was gone and then said, voice lowered, "Hey, Benny, Victoria was not your fault. It could have happened to anybody. You were blindsided." I turned my head. I could do that now. And looked at Ray, at his dear face and the bandages on his arm and chest, and told him the truth. "I was going with her, you know." "I know. I was there. The doctor didn't want to let me out, but I had to be there." He looked down at his hands, then up again, meeting my eyes. "I was the one who shot you." "Oh." "I mean, I didn't mean to. She was going to attack you, we all thought she was, and then..." He took a deep breath and turned away. I tried to think of something more appropriate to say than "oh," but didn't come up with anything. "Shouldn't you still be in the hospital, too?" I finally said. "It's been almost a week. You've been sleeping a lot. Oh, and I got them to scrap those tests. You don't have to worry." "Tests?" "You know, the blood tests. I mean, once they saw she wasn't a delusion of yours, you weren't under suspicion anymore." "Oh. I'd almost forgotten. Thank you. Don't mention it, Benny." Ray knew about me, but he didn't mind. It had been longer than I cared to think about since someone close to me had known I was a shifter. My mother, long ago. Quinn. My grandparents. My father, I suppose. Ray's acceptance eased something inside of me. I breathed in, and the pain when my ribcage expanded felt blurred and far away. Analgesics, probably. Ray had shot me. It had been an accident, but I was still lying here in a hospital bed, and she was gone. "They haven't found her, you know," Ray said. I blinked, and it was an effort to open my eyes again. I wasn't sure if I really did. The ceiling was beige, but it looked white. It was snow, unbroken except for the tracks of a wolf. I knew they were heading north. The end. This has been a reading of Into the Wild by Luzula. For more of the author's work, visit archiveofourown.org/users/Luzula. Another Way, a Due South Story by Luzula, read by Helen78. Victoria sat beside me by the downed airplane where we had spent the night. We drank our tea, and steam rose from our cups, but neither of us said anything. I had refused to let her go. Last night, as we lay side by side, she had tried words and reason, and when that failed, she had whispered of our freedom, hers and mine together. I had said no, although it was the hardest thing I have ever done. But as I packed my things in preparation for taking her to the detachment at Haines Junction, she looked at me with new determination in her eyes. I can tell them about you. Did you think about that? What do you think your precious RCMP will do when they find out that you're a shifter? My hands slowed and stilled, holding my empty cup. Ben, don't you see? You have to come with me. There was hope in her eyes now, and it was painful to see. Of course. Did I think it was possible to do this without cost to myself? You could tell them yes. I couldn't stop you. And that's why you have to let me go. Or come with me. It would be the worst kind of hypocrisy if I expected her to face the uncertain justice of the court when they knew she was a shifter, but could not myself face the RCMP the same way. It was only fair, I supposed. Or at least, there was a kind of symmetry in it. I can't do that, I said heavily. Victoria looked incredulous. Are you serious? You're going to go back and wreck your career over this? When you could... She broke off, still shaking her head in disbelief. Apparently so, yes. It was in some measure a relief. I had lived a double life for so long, and I was heartily sick of it. Now my duty, of all things, would make an end to it. She slumped, the final glitter of hope leaving her eyes. It left her face pale and set. You're crazy. That's possible. Victoria said nothing during the drive down to Haines Junction, not that I could have heard her over the engine of the snowmobile. It was not until she sat cuffed in our sole interrogation room in front of me, Constable LaRouche, and Sergeant Steed that she spoke. Your Constable Fraser is a shapeshifter. I had expected triumph or the satisfaction of revenge in her voice, but there was none. It was as if she spoke her allotted lines in some grim play. Tit for tat. An eye for an eye. Sergeant Steed threw me a sharp glance, then he turned it on Victoria. Why do you say that? I'm a shifter myself. We know our own kind. The sergeant looked unsurprised at this. Clearly the American police had told him of the circumstances of Victoria's crime. Sergeant Steed looked cautiously at me. Is this true, Constable? I stood straighter, automatically putting my hands in the position of parade rest. Yes. I heard Victoria's indrawn breath, and I met her eyes. I don't know if she had expected me to deny it, but I saw no point to that. It would only mean a period of delay while my blood was tested, and despite my subterfuge during my years in the RCMP, I didn't care for a direct lie to my superior officer. I saw Constable LaRouche move his hand slightly toward his gun. An unconscious movement, no doubt. Sergeant Steed kept his eyes on me. Constable LaRouche, lock up the suspect. The extradition paperwork will probably come through tomorrow, and we can send her on to the Americans to deal with. So you never thought that this little detail was something you should tell the RCMP about? The sergeant asked me. Not if it doesn't impact my ability to do my job, I said. Do you have complaints about my performance, sir? Your record is good, he said grudgingly. But that's not the issue. Yes, it is, I wanted to say, though I didn't. Sergeant Steed would not appreciate a direct contradiction. He was an officer of the strict, old-fashioned kind. No, it won't do. How do you think the public would react if they knew that the very force that is to keep them safe at night had shifters among them? I would hope that the RCMP doesn't believe in old superstitions, sir. His eyes narrowed. They're not all superstitions, Constable. There was the case last year with a shifter running wild in Edmonton, and look at the suspect you brought in. She killed her own lover. Respectfully, sir, most violent crimes are committed by ordinary humans. Ordinary humans don't rip people's throats out. The sergeant surreptitiously rubbed his palm on his leg as if his hands were sweaty, and although his expression was stern, he wouldn't quite meet my eyes. He was afraid of me. I wondered what stories he'd heard as a child. Perhaps that shifters had unnatural strength, and that we could hypnotize with our eyes. Or perhaps even the old tale that we stole babies from their beds at night. I sighed and tried once more, although I was beginning to suspect that it was futile. I assure you, sir, that I'm as loyal to the RCMP as any human could be. In the end, I walked out of the sergeant's office stripped of my badge and my uniform. My apartment had been provided by the RCMP, and that, too, was taken from me. I gathered my things, gave away what I didn't need, and camped out in the woods outside Haines Junction. I owed it to myself and to other shifters to try one more time, so I wrote a carefully worded appeal. I also called my father, although not because I wanted him to use his influence unduly, of course. We didn't speak often, but I wanted him to hear this from me, and not by means of gossip. "There's a certain value in pragmatism," I could hear his sigh on the other side of the line. "And you say that?" I couldn't count the number of stories I'd heard of his and Buck's relentless pursuit of criminals, no matter the obstacles in their way. "Some things are hard to fight. Be careful, son." He didn't say, "or you'll end up like your mother," but the words hung between us nevertheless. Winter had almost passed before I received the reply to my appeal, which, despite its diplomatic wording, was a denial of my request. Sitting by my small campfire, I looked into the flames, folded the paper, and put it back in its envelope. There was nothing for me in Haines Junction anymore, and my freedom left me at a loss. Always before, when I had moved from one town to another, it had been on the orders of the RCMP. I rose, fetched water from the creek, and hung the teapot on the tripod over the fire, feeling the need for something to warm me. When I was younger, I would have asked Quinn for advice. He had taught me how to be a shifter, and how to strive for balance between my two selves. But I suspected that Quinn would never have joined the RCMP in the first place, wouldn't have pledged himself to something that couldn't accept him as a shifter. Well, I would just have to find myself something else to do. Perhaps I would move north again. I sipped my tea while the evening settled softly around me. Somewhere in a treetop, a black-capped chickadee sang its short, repetitive song. The moon rose a few days from full. There was no compulsion yet, only a gentle but insistent nudge at the back of my mind. I hadn't changed in a while, and for once there was no reason I shouldn't. I gave in to it with something like happiness. I pulled my clothes off, folded them neatly, and put them in the tent. Then I set my feet on the cold earth and shifted, feeling my senses open to the world. Putting my nose to the ground, I drew in the rich, raw smell of decomposing leaves. There were no new leaves on the trees and bushes yet, but I could feel them waiting. The land was awakening, unfolding itself to the warmth of spring. I snuffled around the camp, noting the trail of a fox that had passed by last night, and a squirrel chattered at me from a tree, safe in the branches. Not much meat on it anyway. A few drops of rain fell, promising a heavy shower soon. I shook myself off and padded into the tent, curling up on top of the sleeping bag. No sense getting wet if I didn't have to. When I slept, I dreamed of her. There were bars between us, and she raised one leg to paw at them impatiently. "Are you coming? I'm tired of this. I want to run." Her eyes gleamed in the darkness, and I poked my nose between the bars to meet hers. I woke, and was confused that she wasn't there. Why wasn't I with her? The patter of rain against the tent had stopped, and I rose and went outside. It was the hour before dawn, and tatters of mist lay between the trees. I stretched the sleep from my body, first my front legs, then my back, and sniffed around the campsite. The fire had gone out, leaving only the spiky smell of ash. There was nothing to hold me here. I went southeast among the foothills of the mountains. The spring melt flooded every brook and stream with icy water. And as I ran south, I met the advancing spring. Day by day, the land was greener, and the birches went from buds to little mouse ears to full green leaves. Game was plentiful, and I kept out of the way of humans. I went to find my pack. I passed the border between British Columbia and Alaska somewhere in the mountains. But there was nothing to mark it, and it didn't interest me in the least. As I came closer to the coast, the air grew heavy and wet, carrying the smell of salt. I hung around the edges of the place called Juneau, careful not to be seen. This was human territory, and I knew she was trapped in a building in this town. But I didn't know where, and however I looked, I couldn't find her. Many houses had dogs, and they would smell me when I came close, barking angrily. I could have shifted, of course, but I'd left all my human things behind. Besides, I didn't want to go back to my other self. I was done with that. It was evening, and I lay underneath a tree with my head resting on my paws. The sky was clear, and the dusk brightened as the moon rose, almost full again. It hung above the trees to the east, big and round. I was alone. No, I was lonely, and I wasn't used to that. The humans didn't want me, and my mate was lost. I sat up, raised my head to the sky, and let all my frustration out in a long, deep howl, again and again. I fell silent, and the sky was silent too. And then, faint but clear, came an answering howl. It was not a dog. I ran toward the sound, desperate to find her before she fell silent. She didn't. She howled until the night was full of her song, pent in and furious. It was a large building, a dark, square thing that looked black in the darkness. But she was not inside it. She was behind a fence, in a small yard with two trees. I ran up to the fence, but she barked in warning, and I stopped. "You came?" "Yes. I waited for you." Her fur had lost its shine, but she was still defiant. Being kept in a cage had not broken her yet, but no one could stand it forever. I wanted the fence gone, and I lunged at it, but her snarl stopped me again. I sat back on my haunches to think. To get her out, I had to change. I needed hands and words. Changing was hard, like trying to find the end of a ball of yarn without fingers to do it with. Finally, I got hold of it, tugged, and sat shivering and naked on the ground. Changing had never been difficult for me before, and it frightened me to have to try so hard. I'd spent a full month as a wolf this time, longer than I ever had before. I looked at Victoria through the wire fence. She watched me steadily, a little wary now that I was human. The fence had a little lightning symbol on it, and I realized with a chill that it was electrified, and I could have gone straight into it. Bit into it, even, the current passing through my tongue. Victoria must have learned the hard way not to attack the fence. The ground was cold, and I stood up, stumbling and uncertain at using two legs instead of four. I looked around. So here I was, apparently just about to break into a United States prison and free one of the inmates. Oh, and I was also naked. I smiled a little, because I suppose it was funny if you looked at it in the right way. Victoria sat still on the other side of the fence. I couldn't read her as well now, but she was a wild animal in a cage, and I had put her there. I should have let her go. Well, I would rectify that mistake now. The skills of a law enforcement officer also served me well in breaking the law. I managed to short-circuit the electric fence, but I certainly wouldn't be able to lift her over it. The top of the fence had cruel-looking barbed wire that leaned inwards. I kneeled down and gripped the metal wire, as if that would bring me closer to her, and looked into her eyes. "Victoria, you need to change." She growled low in her throat and attacked the fence with her teeth. There was no humanity in her eyes. "Please, you can't get out like this. At any moment a guard might come along. Victoria. Victoria." I repeated her name over and over, hoping that would rouse the human in her. Her ears flicked, and her gaze wavered. I stared into her eyes until she finally shifted, flowing into human shape. Pale and naked, she knelt on the ground on the other side of the fence, opposite me. Then her mouth set, and she began to climb up the fence. When she reached the inward-leaning barbed wire, she paused. I began to climb up on the other side to see if I could do anything to help her. An alarm began to ring, shrill and insistent. Victoria took hold of the wire, and in one convulsive moment she swung one leg over, then the other. I could hear her gasp of pain as the barbs cut into her. Then she was scrambling down the other side, and I dropped to the ground beside her. "Are you all right?" I asked. But she was already changing back, stumbling as she began to run. I heard shouts behind us. As I ran toward her, I shifted back too, and it was easy, like water flowing downhill. We left the prison behind, running into the night. Victoria's blood trail would be easy to follow if we did nothing to hide it. She found a small creek, and we ran up it, the water cold and soaking my fur. At dawn, Victoria slowed, her flanks heaving with breath. She was not in good shape, and I could feel her ribs when I nudged at her side with my nose. We rested in a thick stand of trees, and I licked at her wounds. They were washed clean by the water, and had stopped bleeding, but they looked ugly, long gashes down the inside of her legs. Even after running through the creek, her matted fur still smelled of the prison. I woke at dusk, hungry and rested. We hunted then and brought down a deer together. Victoria ate, but not so much as she would need to recover. I stood back from the kill. Eat. No. We must run. And we did. We ran for days until we were deep in the mountains. No one seemed to hunt us, and I hadn't smelled a human for days. Victoria finally relaxed, and that night she ate her fill, gorged herself on meat until her belly was distended with it. Sated, we slept the next day, and only rose the next evening to drink the water that ran down from a peak nearby. It tasted flat and cold, like snow. Then we lay down to rest again, and I tucked my nose close by Victoria's neck. It was spring even in the high mountains now. Birds sang all around us, although they meant nothing to me. They flew away too quickly to catch. Purple flowers dotted the dark rock, and only on the high peaks was there any snow left. We moved slower now that there was no hurry, stopping to get sidetracked by scent trails, or to roll around and play together on the grass, mock snapping at each other. Victoria's wounds healed, and her fur grew healthy and glossy. In some ways, this was the happiest time in my life. Time passed, and I didn't mark it. Summer came, and we moved with it, slowly making our way north. The land changed, from mountains to rolling hills to flat taiga. I knew this kind of land, and it felt good to me. We passed the markings of other wolves at times and avoided their territory. There was plenty of space. No need to pick a fight. Sometimes when we slept, Victoria's paws would twitch as she ran in her sleep. Perhaps she was chasing a rabbit. But I would dream of other things. Warm, flickering light. A campfire burned low, the coals glowing red. Beside it, Victoria and I would sit, telling stories. Or I would dream of skin, pale and hairless, and dark hair longer than any fur. I would dream of touch, of fingers spread wide, tangling together. I would dream of words, written on a page or spoken aloud. When I woke, my dreams faded away, the way scent dissolves in water. I would be back in the world of here and now, and there was no space for anything else. The days grew shorter, and one night the air was sharp with the bite of frost, but it did not greatly concern us. When the first snow fell, we played in it, trying to catch the big flakes and feeling them melt on the tongue. On the thin layer of new snow, prey was easy to track. The next evening I smelled smoke on the wind, sharp and somehow familiar. We skirted the group of cabins, only seeing them from a distance in the night. But there was easy prey nearby, white animals that were soft and penned in by fences. They died easily when Victoria laid into them, their blood red and steaming. She didn't hesitate, bending her head to bite into the meat. I laid my ears back in unease. It belongs to the humans. But now it's mine. She bared her teeth, claiming the kill. The flock was bleeding and stampeding inside the fence, and a dog began to bark at one of the cabins. Victoria reluctantly left her meat, and we slunk into the forest. But that was not the end of it. Victoria seemed to enjoy the easy killing, and we found another flock at the neighboring farm the next night. I hung back, but Victoria slipped under the fence, a dark shadow slashing at the terrified sheep. The humans were waiting for us. There they are. A dog barked, and there was a bright light. I ran, circling around the flock of sheep, desperate to see where Victoria had gone. I couldn't leave her here. I saw her among the sheep, blood on her muzzle. Then she ran, low to the ground, toward me and the safety of the forest. I turned as she passed me and gathered speed to follow her. They're running! Get them! There was a crack that hurt my ears, and a sharp pain in my side. I kept running, but my legs did not obey me. They faltered, even though I strove toward the forest, toward Victoria, with all my heart. My sight seemed to go hazy, and I fell slowly, as if in a dream. The pain was distant, and there was red blood on the snow. My last thought was, Victoria, keep running. The end. This has been a reading of Another Way by Luzula. For more of the author's work, visit archiveofourown.org/users/Luzula. Shifting. A Due South Story by Luzula. Read by Helen78. My earliest memories are of fur. Softness surrounding me everywhere and a wet nose in my ear. There are no more details, only a vast sense of safety and of my mother's presence. She was my whole universe. I wasn't able to change then myself, of course, but she hunted for me, licked me clean, sang me to sleep, and stroked my hair with gentle hands. Whichever shape she took, she was there for me. I don't remember seeing other people, except for my father, on those rare occasions when he was home. My father was big and red, and would have seemed an intruder to me if not for my mother's welcoming arms. He came, stayed a few days, and left again. When she was shot, it was beyond my ability to understand. She had been so strong that she'd once frightened off a hunting wolverine. How could she die? Dying was what animals did, the ones that she killed for us to eat. It was only later that I understood that some considered her to be no more than an animal. Her murderer claimed that she was trying to take his hens and had threatened his life. He went free. No one could prove that he'd known she hadn't been simply a wolf. And so she died, for three hens and a man's prejudice. The city is another wilderness. There are trails in it that humans do not see. The alleys where they throw their trash and trade pleasure for money are layered over with smells that tug at my nose as clearly as neon signs. This is my territory. I'm in heat. Come and mate with me. I hunted and killed here. Most are from dogs. Very rarely do I sense the tracks of someone like me, though we mostly shun the cities. Diefenbaker runs beside me. The full moon stands high above the city, making his fur shine silver. He whines, trying to convince me to stay, but I must go back now. The reason is blurred to me, a reason that belongs to the human world, but it tugs at me with the call of duty, nevertheless. I think it's something to do with papers, probably. Useless things, not even good to eat. It's a human thing, I tell him, and he waffles in disdain. I head towards home, running silently and swiftly through the streets and the dark shadows of the parks. Few humans are awake yet, and if they see me, they will think I am only a large dog, running loose. I jump easily through the open window, then stretch myself upwards for a dizzying moment, until I stand naked and human on the floor of my office. It's easy to slip between shapes at the full moon, or hard not to do it is perhaps the better way to put it. I couldn't have stayed human tonight even had I wanted to. Suddenly tired, I sit down on my cot and pull on my long johns. In a few hours I must rise again and button up my uniform for another day of paperwork. My wolf self, slinking back into the deep corners of my mind, wants to growl in boredom and contempt. Well, if I am lucky, perhaps I can do some liaising with Ray. I lie down gratefully on the cot, sinking into deep, dreamless sleep. Puberty is never particularly easy for anyone, I suppose, but for me it was doubly hard. Until then, no one knew whether or not I would inherit the lycanthropy. It's governed by a complex combination of recessive genes, and the probability was anything between 20-60%, depending on my father's genome. The first sign of it came at about the time my voice began to deepen. There would be an itch in my bones on the nights around full moon, a restlessness that kept me sleepless in my bed, sheets uncomfortable no matter which way I turned. Of course, it could just as well have been psychosomatically induced, but as it turned out, it wasn't. One night, something gave way in my head, as of a door unexpectedly opening, to tumble me dizzy and confused into a new world. It terrified me. The dark room was thrown suddenly into sharp focus, and I moved, but my body didn't move the way I expected it to. I began to whine, a high, keening sound. The door opened, and my grandmother was there in her long nightgown. "Oh, Benton," she said, with a tenderness I rarely saw from her. She came up to me and put her hand out for me to smell. There was no fear in her eyes. "Easy now. You'll be all right." I snuffled in her familiar scent, soap and dry books and tea, so strong to me now. She put her hand on my flank to stroke it, and I began to calm down. "Hey, Fraze, you look dead tired. What's the matter?" "I'm exhausted enough to be direct. I know Ray won't let it go. I didn't get much sleep last night, but I'm all right." "Huh. You having a hard time sleeping?" Ray frowns, a wrinkle forming between his eyebrows. "So are you sure you want to do the stakeout with me?" "I can handle it."
Yeah, I know you can. I'm just worried about you. He does look honestly worried, and I feel ashamed of my lies by omission. I look down, avoiding his eyes. Thank you, but I'm all right. I promise. After approximately 2 hours of stakeout, I almost wish I'd changed my mind and gone home. My sense of smell, which tends to become more acute at this time of month, is drowning me in Ray's scent of clean perspiration, soap, and hair gel. I dislike the chemical smell of the latter, but the male scent of his sweat is, I admit, inappropriately arousing. So this is probably a waste of time, right? Johnson's not going to show up. Ray twirls his car keys on his index finger. I follow their hypnotic motion with my eyes. Well, you never know. Anything could happen, I say inanely. Yeah, right. Ray raises his eyebrows. I mean, he could burst out of that window wearing a pink tutu and rabbit ears. Any moment now. Despite, or perhaps because of, my exhaustion, I find this inordinately funny. Ray elbows me in the side. You know, you're kind of cute when you giggle. I did not giggle. Did too. Still laughing, I give it up as a lost cause. At times I'm fairly sure Ray is flirting with me, but I steel myself to ignore it. The one time I told a potential lover the truth about me, the results were disastrous. I don't want to think Ray would react like that, but caution is too ingrained in me. Freak. Less than human. If I hadn't had Quinn, I don't know what would have happened to me. Some shifters, especially those in urban environments, never learn to control the change and spend their lives in mental institutions. Well, control is perhaps not the right word. One can't view it as a process where one's human self is wholly in charge. But living among the Inuit as I was, I found that there was a much higher level of acceptance for these things, and a tradition for dealing with it. Quinn would go running with me to teach me. I was almost overwhelmed at first by the richness of the world. The cool smell of dew on the sedge, the crisscrossed scent trails of mice living their tiny lives, the shifting hints of larger animals on the wind. In human form, I can't articulate how it feels to live that way. It isn't simply a matter of inhabiting another body. I am, in part, something else. You have to find a balance, he would say later, when we were human again. Fight it, and you will lose part of what you are. Let it take you over completely, and you will cease to be human. It's always been an uneasy truce for me. I'm not like Quinn, who seems to seamlessly inhabit both worlds. When I was at Depot, I never told anyone. I had learned too well the lesson of my mother's death, and luckily lycanthropy does not show up in blood samples, at least in the standard tests, so no one ever knew. It wasn't an easy time for me. Despite Quinn's warnings, I stubbornly tried to suppress the change at first, shivering in my dorm bed at night. The room was dark, but I could feel the full moon above the roof of the building, tugging at me, coercing me until I slunk like a dog brought to heel out of the room and through the bathroom window. The park was a poor substitute for the vastness of the tundra, and dangerous if I were to be discovered, but it kept me from losing my mind. It isn't until the Muldoon case that I finally find the courage. Even then, it is Ray who forces the situation to a head. He was always braver than I. The night after the successful resolution of the case, we both lie sleepless in our tent, pretending to be asleep. I don't know Ray's reason, but there will be a full moon in a few days, and I am resisting the tide in my blood as best I can. I can hear him breathing and fidgeting, small movements that I could not have heard without my heightened sense of hearing. "Hey," he whispers. "You asleep?" I consider continuing the pretense, but give it up. No. Been lying awake for some time, he admits. I wanted to ask you something. Hmm? This is maybe kind of dumb, but you remember what we said in the crevasse? He goes on quickly before I can reply. I want to do that. You know, have an adventure up here. With you. Oh. The idea takes root in my mind and unfolds, and I want it. I want it too much. Yeah, I guess it was kind of a dumb idea, Ray says, barely audible. And I realize I've been silent too long. No, it's not. There is no way that I could hide what I am out on the trail. Yeah? There are things you don't know about me. Yeah, I've figured that. So tell me.
Ray's eyes are intent on me, and it's a challenge. There is no way that I can avoid telling him, I realize, because if I don't trust him now, something in our partnership will be irrevocably damaged. All right, I say, before I can change my mind. Close your eyes, please. What? He says, surprised. But he closes them, and I wriggle out of my long johns in the sleeping bag. Ray may not be able to see, but there is nothing wrong with his hearing. Fraser, what are you doing? Are you taking off your clothes? Yes, I answer tersely, goosebumps rising on my skin in the chilly air. Count to 10 and then you can look. I take a deep breath and give in, flowing into my other self. My senses sharpen. Ray mouths 8, 9, 10, silently, and opens his eyes. He lies absolutely still at first, his breathing making clouds in the air. Of course, the tent is quite dark, and Ray's night vision isn't like mine. Fraser, he whispers. Is that you? He sounds shocked, but there is no smell of fear about him. I move my head up, then down, the motion unnatural and awkward in this body. Right. Okay, buddy. He hesitantly stretches out his hand, and I sniff it delicately. When I smell him, that Ray scent that I have so far only smelled while I am human, something comes together inside me. Ray is pack. The sense of belonging settles deep in my bones, in the part of me that is purely wolf. I lick Ray's hand, wanting to taste him, too. Hey, yeah, now I see where that thing you have for licking comes from, he mutters, then turns serious. Fraser. Huh, strange to call you that now. Anyway, I really see how you might not want just anyone to know this. But believe me, it'd take more than this to freak me out, okay? He moves his hand closer. Can I touch you? In reply, I nudge my head against his palm. He curves his fingers around my ear, gently scratching it, and I want to melt with pleasure and affection. I whine slightly, and his other hand comes up, stroking the fur around my neck. Can you change back whenever you want? Ray asks. In reply, I reluctantly withdraw from his hands. I concentrate, reaching for my human self, and then I am lying naked on top of my sleeping bag. I'm somewhat appalled at the way I just shamelessly encouraged Ray's touch. Feeling shy, I quickly get inside the bag. I glance at Ray, and I can't be sure, but I think he's blushing. Thank you, I whisper, for understanding. I told you, it's all right. Giving in to the urge to shift has lessened it, and I am close to sleep when Ray whispers, So what about the adventure thing? You want to do it? Yes, very much so. I whisper back. Quinn was pack in some sense, I suppose. My first pack after my mother. But we always knew that it wouldn't last. He taught me so that I could move on, as young wolves do. I really couldn't put my finger on the empty feeling inside me until I met Diefenbaker. It wasn't that I was unhappy, more that something was missing, though I didn't know what. But when I woke in that mineshaft from a wet tongue on my face, and opened my eyes to see a wolf cub looking down at me, something changed. Of course, at the time, I thought I was just feeling my head injury. Then I realized that Deef recognized me for what I was. He lowered his body, sticking his tail between his legs in the submissive body language of a young wolf greeting the alpha of its pack. Pack. The word resonated in my mind. Of course. No wonder I'd been lonely. I couldn't shift then. But I acknowledged him the best I could, leaning over to put my hand on his neck and let him lick my jaw. Hey, you gonna let me drive sometime? Ray twists his neck and looks at me impatiently from his place in the sled. I shout at the dogs and break the sled to a stop. Of course. It's inefficient anyway for one of us to ride on the sled. It leaves less room for provisions. We'll stop and pick up more food and fuel the day after tomorrow. So if I'm driving, what are you gonna do instead of sitting in the sled? I stamp the snow anchor in, probably unnecessary with Deef in the lead, but better to be safe, and unzip my parka. Well, I'll be sharing the lead position with Deef. I strip out of my layers quickly, bending down to unlace my boots. You... what? Ray's eyes wander downwards, but he jerks them up to my face quickly. As I said. Now, do you remember what I told you earlier? Break the sled when it's downhill, walk beside it on the uphill. Otherwise, just hold on. We'll handle the rest. I grin widely and put my feet down in the numbing snow. Yeah, sure. He still looks stunned,
Wait, where's the extra harness? But it's too late. I'm already shifting, leaving my two legs and opposable thumbs behind for the swiftness of four legs. I dig with my nose in the side pocket for the harness and stick my head in it, guiding Ray's hands to help me. When he closes the snap to connect me to the gang line, I raise my head to the clear blue sky and yip in anticipation. The rest of the team joins me in a loud chorus. Deef strains in his harness beside me, and I paw the snow impatiently. Dimly, I remember that making noise like this is something I try to discourage when I'm human. But fuck that. I just want to run. Hey, take it easy, Ray says. I loll my tongue out in return, daring him to make me. He shakes his head and goes to loosen the snow anchor. Ray's shouted, "Mush!" is entirely unnecessary, and I throw my weight against the harness and pull. I don't think I've ever felt this whole, as if every part of me, human and wolf, is coming together with one single purpose. The snow sparkling and firm under my feet, the cold air rushing in my lungs. And most important, my pack, traveling together. I turn aside when I see a likely place to spend the night, barking sharply at the other dogs to warn them to slow down. Ray gets off the sled, remembering to anchor it first, and comes up to let me and Deef out of harness.
So you're too tired to run anymore, huh? He grins.
Deef growls at the affront. I splay my front legs out playfully, judging Ray's stance, and then we jump up as one, toppling Ray over into the snow.
Hey, what do you think you're...
I take one ear and Deef the other, and Ray is most thoroughly licked. All right, I take it back, I take it back! We back off to let him up, and he brushes the snow off his clothes. I reach up, changing to my human shape, then immediately start to shiver. Perhaps it was premature to change before I had my clothes unpacked, although I don't know how I could have taken them out without hands. I run over to the sled and rummage around for them. Ray's laughter follows me.
You freezing your ass off, or what?
I don't reply, trying to salvage some of my dignity.
Mighty fine ass, too, Ray mutters under his breath as I pull my clothes on.
I heard that, Ray.
Oh, yeah?
He's grinning, and suddenly there is no reason in the world why I shouldn't have what I want. I turn to him and kiss him until neither of us can breathe anymore. His face is cold, but his tongue is warm against mine. I draw back, panting. Perhaps we should... I make a vague gesture towards the sled, though what I'm really trying to say is, perhaps we should put up the tent and crawl naked into the sleeping bags together? He's nodding slowly, and his eyes are intent on me.
Yeah, perhaps we should.
But the dogs need food and care, and it's almost 2 hours of snow melting and paw checking later before we finally get the tent up. I feel like I've been hard for at least half that time. Ray catches me trying to adjust myself through my suddenly uncomfortable thermal pants, and chuckles. I can see the tip of his tongue, and it does not help.
In the tent, I arrange the thermal pads and sleeping bags. Ray's voice just outside the thin fabric says, "You finished?"
"Yeah, you can come in." I'm afraid my patience is at an end, and when Ray crawls in, I grab him by the front of his parka and push him down, straddling his hips.
You in a rush or what?
I hear myself growling a little as I try to get through his clothes. The process of undressing is far too complicated, and we struggle with zippers, buttons, and drawstrings until the tent is a mess of our discarded clothing. Finally, we are inside the sleeping bags, skin against skin. We're kissing breathlessly, and I roll on top of Ray, holding him down with my weight as I thrust against him. We both moan simultaneously, and Ray tries to spread his legs, cursing as they tangle in the confined space. It's uncoordinated and awkward, and the most satisfying sex I've had in my life. I bite down on Ray's shoulder, moving against him in uneven rhythm. I'm probably marking him, but I don't care. In fact, the thought makes me groan as I spill against his belly. I reach down in the mess between us and grab Ray's erection, thick and hot, in my hand. It only takes a few strokes before he's shaking and coming underneath me. Orgasm knocks both of us out like lights, and I only wake when Ray pushes at me, trying to get me to move.
"Umph," I protest, resenting the disturbance and the cold air that makes its way in.
"You're squashing me. My leg's asleep." I shake my head, trying to clear it. I seem to be lying half on top of Ray.
"Sorry."
God, we're a mess. And we stink. It's true, the smell of sex is everywhere on our sticky bodies. I like it, I say without thinking. The scent of my semen on Ray's body, mingled with his own scent, makes me stir again.
You would, weirdo.
He kisses me, and I wince a little at the stubble burn I didn't notice until now. Ray rolls me over on my back. You know, just because you're some kind of alpha wolf sometimes doesn't mean you get to be on top all the time. I think as well as I can while Ray is rubbing against me. Yes, I suppose I was a little assertive before. Of course not. Wolves do have strict dominance hierarchies, but I'm human too, not just a wolf. Oh yeah? He says. In reply, I slowly turn my head aside to expose my neck. That, at least, should be body language he understands. I can hear his rapid breathing as he leans down and gently puts his mouth on me. His tongue follows my stretched tendon, then I feel his teeth closing on my neck. I gasp, jerking my hips up. Yes, I... Please. Yeah, I got you. Ray lies down behind me and licks his hand, then strokes me slowly, his thumb rubbing the head, until I'm begging to come. He finishes me off with a couple of hard strokes and comes a few moments later, thrusting between my thighs. I almost fall asleep again, but rouse myself enough to wipe us off. The sleeping bags are soiled enough as it is. But I don't really care. All I know is that on this quest, for the first time that I can remember, the human and wolf in me are of one mind. Life is good. The end. This has been a reading of Shifting by Luzula. For more of the author's work, visit archiveofourown.org/users/Luzula.